Thank you, Madam Clerk. Welcome to the October 15th strategic planning meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. As we convene, I will, as always, remind you, if you need assistance hearing the proceedings in chambers, we do have hearing assist devices located at each end of the dais. And with that, I would invite you please to rise and follow me in the flag salute.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Madam Clerk, changes for today's agenda.
Amendment number one to the October 15, 2013 board agenda. Added item to closed session, two, personnel. It is the intention of the board to meet in closed session to consider public employee appointment for the position of library director. Requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied, as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour notice of requirement.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. We don't have a consent agenda today. That sounds like a good idea. We will start public comment on items not on the agenda in just a bit here, but first I would like to introduce Ms. Kathy Kibley, who has just been hired as the new general manager of the Los Osos CSD. And with that, I congratulate you on that appointment and look forward to working with you in the future. Would you like to say hello?
Good morning. I appreciate the introduction and you taking the time. And I, too, look forward to working with you, as does the district. And I thank you very much for this opportunity. And I'm here this morning just to listen and learn.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kibler. All right. With that, I have seven requests in general public comment, maybe one or two more coming in, eight. We'll start with Ron Alsop, followed by Ben DeFada.
Good morning. Ron Alsop, County Office of Emergency Services. I'd like to remind everybody that Thursday is the annual Great California Shakeout, although over the past few years it's expanded significantly beyond California, but for us here locally still referred to as the Great California Shakeout. And that's the time we take annually, just a couple of minutes, in this case October 17th, so 10:17 at 10:17 a.m., to actually duck, cover, and hold, or take alternate protective measures, or at the very least we encourage people to think about what they would do in an earthquake. As we're very well experienced here in San Luis Obispo County, we have had and can have at any moment a significant damaging earthquake. And this is a widespread event. There are over 43,600 people signed up to participate throughout San Luis Obispo County, including the San Luis Obispo County government itself, signed up with the official shakeout page, Superior Court, school districts, Cal Poly, and many other local organizations. So we encourage people to take this seriously, specific to county and county employees. County risk management safety folks will be participating with several county departments in the actual drill, again, at 10:17 a.m. this Thursday. And for additional information, there's the contemporary way to get information would be on the website at shakeout.org. Again, shakeout.org. And people can also join the already 43,600 people in the county that have signed up there. And then also for the those without electronic access, reminder that the AT&T Yellow Pages, or the YP as they call them these days, still has great safety information in the front. And the White Pages, they have good first aid information, earthquake information, and information on Diablo Canyon preparedness. Thank you.
Mr. Alsop, thank you very much. You know, a small in almost symbolic action on one day a year that could really save some lives if people just internalize it. Again, any more, want to repeat the contact information for where folks can get more information about the shakeout?
Certainly, at shakeout.org online. Again, shakeout.org. And then also for those without access or easy references, the AT&T phone book, which is now that big yellow phone book with, they just call it YP now. So the YP, up in that the White Pages, they have great safety information. So shakeout.org.
Very good. Thank you, sir. Yeah. Mr. DeFada, followed by Eric Greening.
Morning, board, sheriff, public, new general manager. I am Ben DeFada from Los Osos, where lately we are seeing our citizens being tired of being ripped off by all levels of government. I have here in my hand in this pink envelope, and why it's pink, I have no idea, a special assessment for the California fire prevention fee of $115 for 1 year on top of the Los Osos special fire tax of $78.10 for the coming year. within 200, 300 feet, there are at least three fire hydrants, and the fire department can be anywhere in Los Angeles in 4 or 5 minutes. We have no forest of trees within a mile, only homes around my property. Now tell me, why am I and my neighbors having to pay this fire tax twice? Looks to me like this is double taxation to too many of us. On the same day, I received literature from our assemblyman, Kacho Achadian, whatever, who is against this special fire tax imposed on us from Sacramento and is fighting to get rid of it for us. On another subject, the property owners that I've talked to are all complaining that the cost of their water coming from the Golden State Water Company is 3 times more than the Baywood Water Company. Both draw their water from the same aquifer, except that one company is for profit and the other one is run by a community service district. Many cities in the country supply the basic needs of its citizens, like water, sewer, natural gas, electricity, and transportation. Some that I've talked to want to form a committee to see if the Los Angeles CSD can change their water supplier from the Golden State Water Company to a local municipality water company. This administration has done everything in its power to destroy the middle class, jobs, won't make this country free of foreign oil, tighten up the border, 1 in 6 on food stamps, and so forth. And the latest being that our citizens can't view the war memorials and other statues in D.C. that have never had a fence around it and that new Obama has ordered. Now Obama has ordered that these memorials and statues be fenced off to our veterans and citizens. Crazy progressive liberals, just like we have here in this room, Mr. Gibson and Ogren, who have never built a store before, will be causing several thousand homeowners and many renters in a prohibition zone to move out of town to cheaper housing. Because of some of this board are stubborn and have their political cronies to take care of, and finding cheaper housing in this state is near extinct. If you want full-blown socialism, go to another country. There's plenty around. About 6 years ago, Mr. Gibson and others went to D.C. for stimulus money for a shovel-ready project that took another 4 years to begin the digging. And in 4 years, the Los Angeles aquifer, it's our only source of water, has suffered salt water intrusion that may never come back to normal.
Thank you, Mr. DeFada. Mr. Greening, followed by Julie Tacker.
Thank you. Good morning. I am Eric Greening, and I'd like to thank Mr. Alsop for the reminder and remind at least two of you that there will probably be a LAFCO meeting going on in this room at 10:17 Thursday morning, and it would be wise for you to observe the shakeout there and perhaps educate the people who are at that meeting who wouldn't otherwise know about it or be prepared for it. I suppose if there's a citizen at this podium at that particular point, they might think they just said something earth-shaking, but anyway. The main thing I wanted to talk about right now, which is another issue of nature and how to prepare for what nature does relative to what our civilization has done, because after all, the danger in an earthquake isn't so much from the earth moving, it's from the things we have built falling on us. There's another human-made disaster that can turn a real gift of nature into something very ugly. I'm talking about first flush. We got a little teaser in the rain department last Wednesday. Probably it will be a month or two before we get a real rain, but when we do, it will have been an extra long period since the last real flushing, cleansing rain. I think it would be close to a year because it was last December when we were having real rains that meant it. Everything that has dripped on pavement in that almost a year will be mobilized into the creeks and into the ocean at that time, and the effect is pernicious. I would suggest a couple of a sort of a multi-staged agendizing and preparation. Number one, agendize as soon as possible a look at what are we doing to prepare for it and what are we doing to gather data. We should have samples in every creek downstream of significant pavement and a report back to the board. which then could be subsequently agendized. Where are the problem areas? How big is the problem? And what are we going to do to not let it happen again? If you've seen the creeks in the immediate aftermath of first flush, it's amazing that anything can live in them during that time. And if it's a major rain, there will be a breaking of sandbars at the mouths of creeks, steelhead trying to migrate upstream to spawn, and they deserve a better welcome than that. I think it may even bring Sammy out on his hind fins to come into this room and complain. Anyway, be prepared. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Ms. Tacker, followed by Lindy Owen.
Good morning. I'm Julie Tacker from District 2 in the Hillsosen. Last Tuesday, your board approved the plans and specs to go out to bid on our overpriced wastewater treatment facility, some $15 million more than it anticipated. That project, our project, was not to have an ocean outfall. Mr. Gibson prided himself, is that a word? Boasted that our project would not discharge to any surface waters. Clearly, we've talked about dewatering to the bay. We're discharging to surface water. Recently, I found out that three new disposal locations have been approved by county staff, and the contractors are dumping in more places than we knew about a month ago. Not less, more. What I wonder is if each of you went and looked at the sewer plant plans that are on file at the clerk's office before you took action last week. There's a spillway. I didn't expect that. I didn't expect that this project would use a creek, ultimately Morro Bay and the ocean, as a relief valve for the treated wastewater should the plant overflow. I'd like to know more about that. We were told time and time again, Mr. Gibson told the Coastal Commission, that we had an extraordinary project that wouldn't do that. Wouldn't do what other communities do by dumping its waste into the bay or into the ocean. The Achilles heel of the project has always been where to put the treated wastewater. Right now, what you've got are sprinkles of water to dry land farmers. You've got a little bit of water on some school turf, but you haven't captured even the golf course or the cemetery, ideal for reuse of treated wastewater. Mr. Ogren was here a couple of weeks ago and he lied to you about the importance and the value of the dewatering water, where it comes from or where it could be going to. You are not exercising the Broderson site. Millions of dollars of infrastructure is there and ready to receive these waters to be percolated back into our ground for the opportunity for us to use it again in the future. And that's not happening. I'd like to know why. And what are you afraid of? Is it going to fail like has been predicted year after year after year?
Thank you, Ms. Tacker. Ms. Owen, followed by Tom Dawson.
Good morning. Lindy Owen from Los Osos. Just a reminder, too, especially Mr. Meacham would probably appreciate the fact that our sewer is now only $3 million less than the Paso Robles sewer. Isn't that interesting? And with no innovation whatsoever, you at least are going to burn methane gas. I come before you again. I'm going to be running pictures of what isn't being addressed. The pride of this project and laying these pipes in the ground, 42 miles of streets being destroyed to put pipes in, is a pride and joy that there's, you know, running a bit ahead, 2 months ahead of schedule and so. The reason they're running ahead of schedule is because they've left a complete mess behind them in such a hurry to get the pipes in that none of the rest of all the crap that's left laying in the roads, the right-of-ways that have been destroyed, about half of them have been destroyed with heavy equipment stored on them. I mean, gigantic things, living on these things day in and day out. Besides, the quality of our streets is pretty much gone, too. But my point is, it's in their contract to fix the shoulders, and I want them fixed before the rain becomes a problem. We're talking about first flush. Believe me, it's not going to be pretty in Los Osos. The bay will be choked with sand. The other issue that I'd like to bring up, this is the last brochure that we got from the sewer project, which, again, it says $5.5 million was put in. We're paying for property relations, is what it's called, to HDR contracting, so that we could have effective and frequent communication to keep the community informed. Well, I don't know. I guess they're using the money for something else, because this was December of last year, and we've seen nothing, zero, since. So if you want to know why the people in Los Osos don't know where they can go and what they can do, it's because they have absolutely no information. They have a website called Dig Los Osos that's usually worthless, not worth looking at. The information's old. The signage is left. I mean, this is a project that is costing us $200 million. I'm paying, every homeowner is paying for this, and this is a third world delivery. I want to talk also about the dumping of what little water we have in Los Osos into the bay. There's absolutely no excuse for it. The reason it's being dumped is because it's not feasible, is the word used, to put it where it belongs, on dry land and up at the Broderson site, which is, it's 8 acres. It's an 8-acre disposal leach field, and the water is supposed to go there. It's easy to pipe it up the side of the road if they can't do it the way they had planned. There's no excuse for postponing this, and dumping into our bay is wasting our water.
Thank you, Ms. Owen. Mr. Dawson, followed by April McLaughlin.
Tom Dawson, good morning. Since so much of what you do is based on global warming and climate change, an enormous UN report on scientific data behind global warming was made available Monday, yet it offers little concrete explanation for an earthly oddity. The planet's climate has hit the pause button. Since 1998, there has been no significant increase in global average surface temperatures, and some areas, notably the northern hemisphere, have actually cooled. The 2,200-page new technical report attributes that to a combination of several factors, including natural variability, reducing heat from the sun, the ocean acting like a heat sink to suck up extra warmth in the atmosphere. One problem with that conclusion, according to some climate scientists, is that the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, has limited the hiatus to 10 to 15 years. Anastasios Tsonis, a distinguished professor at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, believes the pause will last much longer than that. He points to repeated periods of warming and cooling in the 20th century. Each one of those regimes lasts about 30 years. I would assume something like another 15 years of leveling off or cooling, he told Fox News. I know that the models are not adequate, Tsonis told Fox News. There are a lot of climate models out there. They don't agree with each other, and they don't agree with reality. In fact, the IPCC's massive, complex new report acknowledges that none of the models predicted the hiatus. The authors write it could be due to climate models overpredicting the response to increasing greenhouse gases, or a failure to account for water vapor in the upper atmosphere. The bottom line is, no one saw it coming. Almost all historical simulations do not reproduce the observed recent warming hiatus, the report states. Judith Curry, who used to be with the IPCC, Chair of the Board of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Georgia Tech says the IPCC is taking a huge credibility hit over the hiatus and over the pronouncement that it is 95% certain that human activity is responsible for most global warming. They have explicit policy agendas. Their proclamations are very alarmist and very imperative as to what we should be doing, and this does not inspire confidence in the scientific consensus, their Thank final product.
You. Thank you, Mr. Dawson.
Thank you.
Ms. McLaughlin, followed by Richard Margetson.
Hello, my name is April McLaughlin, and I live in the Five Cities, and I wanted to let everyone know that the Oceano Farmers Market fundraiser that we had on September 28th was a great success. And I also, outside of that, want to give appreciation that we now have a district supervisor again for our area, and very excited about that. One of the things that struck me when Ms. Ray came to the OCSD meeting last Wednesday was that without a public slip, she was more than welcomed to speak at the podium, and that our area comes from that kind of government inclusiveness in allowing the public to speak at public government issues. Arroyo Grande, the mayor, is very welcoming when items come up on the agenda to ask if the public has any comment, whether they've turned in a slip or not. So that I hope Ms. Ray brings that spirit to you guys instead of you guys bringing your spirit to her, and that's what I wanted to address. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. McLaughlin. Mr. Margetson, our last request to speak.
Richard Margetson, for our new supervisor. There was an interesting dynamic in the room during the Los Osos issue last week that, having not been here, you need to be brought up to date. Mr. Hill, his entire term as supervisor, has never asked a question on the Los Osos wastewater project, ever. Hours and hours of meetings. Last week, he asked a number of questions, that the people observing in Los Osos thought were fifth grade questions on a graduate school project. But it must be campaign season for Mr. Gibson, starting a little early. Maybe that's why Mr. Hill's taking some of the heat off for him. So at the end, Mr. Hill talked about how he had been in Los Osos and been at a birthday party and with colleagues from Cal Poly, and to a person, nobody had a problem with the issue. I'm sure Cal Poly professors don't have a problem paying for the wastewater project. It's probably going to be a little impact on their annual budget. But as president of People Helping People in Los Osos, that provides the food giveaway every Wednesday at the community center, I ask him to come and talk to the people that are standing in that line and how this project's going to affect them at $150, $160, $140, whatever it shakes out at. There's people there that are petrified of what's coming down the road. They're standing in line for food. I found it very condescending that that is the stance. But that's the stance you're always going to hear from Mr. Gibson, and I guess Mr. Hill now, is everything's fine, there's no complaints. You need to come into the community and get a feeling. I'll be happy to take you on a tour of the community and introduce you to people that are really concerned and are really going to be affected by this project, that are probably going to have to move out of town. And then on another note, Mr. Gibson said he's going to bring back Title 19 at some point for some corrections. Title 8, the retrofit upon sale ordinance, probably needs to come back too. There's a couple major inconsistencies with the requirements of the wastewater project for connection to the plant. One of them, I'll just bring up one of them. Retrofit upon sale says a showerhead replacement has to be 2.5 gallons. The wastewater project's 1.5 gallons. The home inspectors and the realtors are confused. There's a lot of inefficiency between these two ordinances.
Thank you, Mr. Margetson. That concludes public comment for items not on the agenda. We'll move on then to the first of our three items for the strategic planning meeting and ask Madam Clerk to introduce that for us, please.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Arnold, do you have...
May we just have a moment to respond to some of the...
Public sure, if you okay. would like to.
I had a couple things, actually. To Mr. Greening's remarks about the rains coming, I know that the Regional Water Quality Control Board in this district has... regionally, at least 50 monitoring sites for doing exactly what you're asking. And I'm sure that the first flush is of interest to them as well. But it is important, and I do think that that agency can provide us, the county, with a lot of materials. They're set up at least 50 sites across the region. So something to – I appreciate your comments on that. And then if there is anyone, I think Mr. Waddell is here. You know, over the months we've heard several times about the public outreach publications for the Los Osos sewer project, and I'm just wondering if I've never really heard anything except for the folks from public comment. Are we supposed to have a schedule for that, or do we have something going on where the people are supposed to be getting some kind of information in their mailbox? How does that all work?
I don't see folks from Public Works here to address that. I don't have the information off the top of my head.
Okay, just wondering.
Happy to speak to, the efforts of the wastewater project. The Dig Los Osos website has got a substantial amount of information. I simply disagree with Ms. Owen's characterization of its timeliness or its content. And we will be, as we get into the next phases of the project, we will be putting out information as we want the public to engage. So we'll be doing that. Right now, we're in the business of trying to get the pipes in the street, and folks are always welcome to call the Dig Los Osos number. They get a response within 24 hours. They can check in through the website. They can call my office. So I don't think there's any lack of means by which folks can get information on the wastewater project. We also have an office set up in Los Osos, and we hold office hours out there. So at least, my memory serves, at least 3 days a week we have folks in the office who will take anybody coming through the door. So that's the nature of the public outreach. We will at some point be having a larger public meeting as we get into the construction of the treatment plant and approach the time when lateral connections to houses are going to be planned for. So we've got a whole program going.
And I appreciate that response. It sounds like there is a lot of information out there. I think I was just trying to clarify whether or not. Because over the months, we've just heard them expecting some kind of... Was there... Like, it was set up for publications to be delivered to the mailbox, and they... So the public should not be expecting that. They should be using these opportunities you've just mentioned.
For now, yes, these opportunities through the website and the phone. We have put out direct mail on a number of occasions when there are issues to be communicated. So,
okay.
That'll happen again.
Hopefully that answers... that question. Thank you. That's all
right.
Good.
Very good. Mr. Buckshy?
Okay. Good morning. Dan Buckshy from the Administrative Office. Assistant CAO Guy Savage and myself are going to jointly present the forecast for the upcoming fiscal year for 14-15 and an outlook beyond that time frame for what the next few years might offer as well. And I am pleased to state that if the forecast is accurate, that it does appear that for the first time in 7 years that we will be crossing back into the black, which I'm sure is welcome news for just about everybody. It's not great news, as we'll see, but it is certainly good news. Just a quick reminder, this current year, fiscal year 13-14, we had a $2 million budget gap. We closed that gap via budget hearings, and we are in the midst of implementing that plan. So, this forecast assumes that we continue to implement into plan, and we'll run according to plan, and we'll run through some of the other assumptions as well. So, let's take a look here at some of the highlights from what we've seen here. The economy has improved this past year. I will speak to that in more detail. And I think the takeaway that we can see is that the county's budget balancing strategies and goals and priorities have worked. The county's budget gap is closing according to the seven-year plan that was put in place. You know, at our peak or trough, depending on your perspective, back in 2009-10, we had a $30 million gap, and that is essentially in the midst of being closed. And again, if the forecast is accurate, it will essentially be closed in 2014-15, which again is obviously quite welcome news. Taking a look in a little more detail of what's occurred the past year, as I mentioned, the economy has grown. The gross domestic product, or GDP, which is the broadest measure of the U.S. economy, grew about 1.5% this past year, which, while certainly is better than being flat or shrinking, as we saw during the Great Recession, it's considerably off from the historical average. Historically, what we've seen is growth in the range of about 3.5% since World War II. So it just underscores what we've been stating and seeing here locally as well, that we anticipate this turnaround and to continue to be slow and steady. There's not any new information at this point that suggests we'll see a jump in the rate of growth. Believe me, we're looking for it. We just haven't seen it. Stock market is up about 15% compared to a year ago. The Dow Jones Industrial Average crossed 15,000 for the first time a few months back and remains at roughly that level. Unemployment does remain a bit stubbornly higher than what most would like, whether it's the Washington politicians or economists. In California, the rate is about 8.7%, 8.5%, give or take. Now, the good news is that's down from about 12.5% back in 2009, but it's still higher than what most would like to see, in and around 6 to 6.5%, which is considered to be a sign of a healthier economy. And then, you know, locally, and we'll run through this in a little more detail later, we've done a little better than California here in San Luis Obispo. Our unemployment rate is in and around 7%, which is fairly close to the national average. So California is faring a little bit worse than we are here locally and as the nation as a whole. So jumping into some of the macroeconomic conditions and what we're seeing. Obviously, a lot of talk right now about the federal shutdown and the looming debt crisis. We spoke a little bit about this last week, but I want to hit on these again. They are really two separate issues. They are being dealt with jointly, essentially, for purposes of leverage, if nothing else, and due to timing. The federal shutdown is related to the federal budget. The federal fiscal year begins October 1st. The president submitted his $3.7 trillion budget to Congress back in April, but Congress has not adopted a plan to send forth to the president or anything that they think he would. I shouldn't say that. They've sent multiple proposals, but nothing that he was willing to sign. So there's obviously a standoff there. So what's different this year and years past, as compared to years past, is that typically, the federal government has not adopted its budget on time by October 1st, but they've passed what are called continuing resolutions, or CRs for short, which essentially extend the existing budget into the new year and allow the government to continue to operate. This year, the two sides have been either unable or unwilling to agree upon the budget and have not passed a continuing resolution. That's why the shutdown went into place about 2 weeks ago now. And we'll see what comes about. I'll speak to where things are at in just a moment. So that's on the shutdown side related to the budget. The debt crisis is related to the amount of debt that the United States has, and we're going to reach that limit. Currently, the debt level is about $17 trillion, just under that, which equates to about $53,000 per citizen or $148,000 per taxpayer. The Congress sets the debt ceiling, and that limit is forecast to be reached on October 17th, which is this Thursday. The issue would be is that the government would not have the funds to service that debt if the debt limit is not increased, which could result, depending how things were to play out, in a default in debt. And as I noted Last year, the United States has never defaulted on its debt, not even during the Great Depression, and that is one of the primary reasons why U.S. treasuries and the like are considered extremely safe investments and are really the benchmark around the world. And there's a significant concern from economists, from large businesses, from just about every other country that owns part of the debt about what might happen should the debt limit not be increased and would there be a default. Would it result in a massive run on treasuries, a major sell-off? Some countries have begun to sell some treasuries in light of that possibility. But it's never happened before, so we really don't know what would happen. Now, that being said, it does appear what may occur is what we've discussed last week, and that it appears the two sides are nearing compromise for some short-term solutions, which would essentially kick this problem down the road to right around the holidays. So it'd be a real nice Christmas present to deal with the shutdown and debt crisis once again and kick off the new year. I'm not sure, you know, what would be accomplished in this additional couple months that couldn't be accomplished now, but that's essentially where things stand. So I would anticipate we'll continue with this level of uncertainty for at least the near term and the foreseeable future. So moving on from that, credit remains somewhat tight. Credit markets all but seized up during the recession, and while they have lightened up a bit, credit is still hard to come by, and that's part of the reason why the economy has not rebounded as quickly as what's occurred after prior recessions. I spoke to unemployment, and you know, with respect to Europe, the economy there remains soft. Some countries are faring better than others, but there has been a significant amount of government intervention to help prop up the European economy, and as a result, it's still on shaky ground. And the concern here is that we live in such a connected world these days, both economically, socially, and essentially across the board, that what happens in Europe would likely not be contained in Europe, that it could spill over and have impacts on our economy here as well. I hit on the GDP component already. We've seen an considerable improvement in the housing market, which is good news, given that an overinflated market is essentially what drove us into the problems that we've been experiencing for the last 6 to 7 years. So it's nice to see that start to turn around. And Guy will share some statistics about that a little bit later. The corporate profits piece is interesting. Profits are high, and corporations are sitting on large amounts of cash, in some cases record levels of cash, and they're reluctant to spend it because of the uncertainty around the economy, which is really driven by the political uncertainty. I think most economists would state that there are definitely solutions that could be put in place to move forward. It's just that Washington can't agree on what those are. And part of the reason we're seeing this slower recovery than what most might expect or occur is partially because corporations are unwilling to invest in a time of uncertainty. And I think most are even on record stating they're fairly open to what the solutions would be. They just want a solution because they want some certainty so that they know how to plan for the future. So this is a key indicator to watch, is where corporate profits are at and what they're doing with their stockpiles of cash, if you will. On this slide, a couple points that are worth discussing in more detail is the quantitative easing, which is some of the actions that have been taken by the Federal Reserve. Essentially, the Federal Reserve is buying $40 billion a month of mortgage-backed securities in order to improve liquidity and essentially pump money into the system to keep the economy going. The Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke is in the full Federal board has been discussing about whether or not it's time to taper back this infusion of cash, if you will. Is the economy on strong enough footing that this could be scaled back and essentially take steps to start closing or reducing at least the debt that we previously discussed? Just about a month and a half ago, this issue came to a head as the Fed had indicated its interest in scaling this back. It backed off after markets went a little sideways and decided to wait longer to begin tapering this. So this is another key indicator to watch. It is a balancing point of how to ease back from this intervention, if you will, but do so in a scalable and sustainable manner, in a safe manner. And then the last point on this slide on some of the federal issues is the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Obviously, October 1st was a big milestone. As folks begin to enroll in that program, there's considerable debate about whether or not this will have a negative impact on the economy. Some argue that it could have a positive impact on the economy, but it's unknown at this point in time just what that impact will be. And we'll speak a little bit later about what we think the impact will be to our budget here locally. And then the last slide that I'll hit on before I hand it over to Mr. Savage is the state budget. And the state budget is in considerably better shape than what it has been in the past. For those of you that were here a year ago, you'll recall that the 12-13 state budget had a gap of about $16 billion. And this year, as you can see, it's essentially in balance. The state budget is just under $100 billion in total. Now, the primary way in which that was closed is that Proposition 30, which increased sales tax and income taxes, was approved by the voters that resulted in an increase of about $15 billion of revenue. So that was the largest driver, if you will, of the way in which the state closed its budget gap. A few things to keep in mind about Prop 30 is that the sales tax component is in place through 2016, and the income tax component, the increase, remains in effect through 2018. So a couple things will likely need to occur. One is that the state will need to grow its revenues so that if these increases were to go away in 4 to 5 years, 6 years, that they'd be offset by an increase in revenues. I think the other likely option is that the voters would be asked to consider extending these again in order to avoid having a big budget gap. And obviously a third option, if neither of those occurred, then the state would be back in the red and looking at having to make cuts once again. And before we move on to our local conditions, are there any questions about the broader macroeconomic level?
Any questions to Mr. Buckshy? Seeing none.
Okay. Hand it over to Mr. Savage.
Okay, I'm going to spend a few minutes talking a little bit more about the current local conditions and some more of the data that went into the actual forecast itself. As noted on the slide here, the housing market, we are seeing higher mortgage rates, slightly higher mortgage rates, and prices and total sales are increasing. Included in the forecast is a sizable property tax increase based on those houses that would be considered in decline, meaning those that we're doing Prop 8 kind of reductions on the tax rates on. So housing market is improving. Also included in the forecast are spending increases that result in about a 17% TOT increase, and we're projecting about a 27% sales tax increase, and those are factored into the forecast. Let's talk some more about building. This slide here shows building permit trends. The top or orange-red line there represents the total number of permits. The yellow line that kind of starts out at the bottom and then increases rapidly toward the end there is the actual construction values. Now, that big increase there is because of the solar plants in the California Valley, obviously. If that weren't there, then you'd see a much flatter line on that side of the chart. Foreclosure trends, let's talk about those for just a minute. Here again, the top line or red-orange line is essentially that line where a homeowner gets a letter from the bank or their mortgage holder that says, hey, you need to pay or face foreclosure. Good news is between 11-12 and 12-13, those are down just over 40%. The bottom line there, which is the number of trustees deeds, which is when the foreclosure actually happens, those between the past 2 years are down about 45%. This slide then kind of culminates by showing, well, how many of those properties that actually started the foreclosure process ended up in foreclosure. So as we see, about 48% of the homes that begin the process actually end up in some sort of foreclosure, whether it's a sales, some other form of financing, or some other mechanism to prevent foreclosure. Regardless, as you can see, as you look toward the left of this particular graph, there's still several times what we would consider normal foreclosure trend rates. Mr. Buckshide mentioned unemployment trends. Here's a quick slide that can take you back several years, back to year 2000, related to unemployment trends. The top line shown in yellow there reflects the state's unemployment rates. The red line that kind of meanders through the middle there represents the national rates. And then the bottom line there in green represents our local unemployment rates. Again, these are still well above what we would consider normal. And Mr. Buckshy mentioned the quantitative easing, tapering. Until those rates get below 6.5%, we won't see quantitative easing kick in. So let's get into some of the forecast assumptions. Again, the forecast focuses primarily on the general fund. It assumes a status quo budget. There's nothing new added for 13-14 or 14-15, meaning no new programs. And that any state expenses or new programs will come with commensurate revenue, so essentially a flat budget. As part of the forecast, we did our best to include assumptions about the Affordable Care Act, but given where we're at in that process, we could not fully consider all of the impacts that it will have. There's just simply too many unknowns. On the revenue side of things, you can see total revenues are about $418 million, that's broken down into a couple of different pieces. You've got non-departmental revenue of $157 million, about a 5% increase. And as I noted earlier, it reflects a significant increase in property tax. You've got departmental revenues of $442 million, about a 3.5% increase. Generally flat, and those reflect some of those state and other programs that we talked about a minute ago. The revenue assumptions assume no general increases in taxes or tax rates, and that we'll have a fund balance at the end of the year about $19 million. While overall properties and recordings have been down, I'm referring to the property tax here, there is a major restoration in those declines in values that I mentioned a few minutes ago. On the expenditure side, total expenditures listed are about $414 million. On the salary and benefits side, we're assuming no compensation increases, about a 1% pension rate increase, and lower worker compensation and liability rates. It's worth noting here that the essential assumption here is that we'll continue to sign agreements with the bargaining units, such as the ones just signed with the DA investigators and sheriff's managers, that were basically two-year deals, included no salary increases, a minor bump in health care reimbursement costs, and a county medical plan opt-out provision. Overall, as you can see there, non-salary assumptions included 2% CPI and a 4% contingency. It's worth noting that our standard policy is 5%, and that was lowered back in 2009-10 when the gap was about $30 million. So here's the magic number that I think many people have been curious to see. Very simple math, your revenues minus your expenditures equal the amount that's available, in this case about $3.9 million. Overall, that reflects less than 1% of the county's operating budget, and our best estimate and forecast is that the overall budget will come in about somewhere between $0 and $6 million. Just to give a little flavor for what that reflects, a 1% change in any of those assumptions I mentioned earlier could reflect as shown here. Non-departmental revenue is about $1.6 million, departmental revenue $2.4 million, salary and benefit costs $2.3 million, and then non-salary costs about $1.6 million. So before I hand it back to Mr. Buckshy for a minute, any questions on that?
Questions to Mr. Savage, Ms. Ray, followed
just
by...
Excuse me.
Go ahead. No, I thought I heard a click on from this side, but I may be hallucinating. So,
just a quick one. When are we looking at possibly returning to 5% for the reserves?
I'll hit on that in just a few moments.
Okay.
Good question.
I'll hold it back. Thank you.
My own heart.
All right. The contingencies are an interesting question. I had one, and I don't know if the assessor's office is here. I assume they might be, but we see property taxes going up about 3%. We had under the provisions of Proposition 8 lowered valuations. Those valuations come up rather immediately, and we sort of track that by the average year, which we've gone back to. And I was just curious as to what year we're at as we come back out of the lowest of the low valuations.
I can try to address that. We know we went as far back as about 2002, I believe, was the decline in value, which was about 40,000 properties, or roughly one-third of all the assessed properties here in the county, just a little bit less than that. I don't know what the exact year is, but I believe they're looking at roughly at least half of those decline in values going away.
I was thinking up. 2008 or 2009. Somewhere.
I think we're in that ballpark there.
Okay, very good. Ms. Arnold.
My question was just about the expectation that there will be no change to workers' comp when we're looking at our budget. So that was just curious to me. I mean, the insurance world seems to be topsy-turvy. We're assuming the Affordable Health Care Act won't have any kind of secondary effect on workers' comp? Or it's a guess? Or is
that's essentially correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Meach?
Yeah, just following up on your point relative to the property tax. And Guy, or Dan, from what I've read, when they go back and recapture that, they also add 2% per year that they were allowed to do. So some folks could be seeing a pretty substantial jump in their property taxes now. Is that correct? Or
that's absolutely correct. You know, the decline in value is what it was reduced to is bumped back up to what the current assessed value is, and it's pegged for whatever the inflator was up to, a maximum of 2%. In addition to bringing it back to its previously established base value. So, yes, there are some folks that will likely be receiving some rather unpleasant bills in the mail. They've already received them.
We'll be getting
weeks
some
ago.
Unpleasant calls from our offices. But yeah. I guess the other question, and I guess that would be the tax collector who could answer this, but because you're seeing such a dramatic jump, is there a way to cushion that somewhat over time as opposed to just one great big increase?
Well, and I think we'll see that over the next couple years. You know, the full prop, all of the 40,000 Prop 8s are not being bumped up all at one time to their full value. We still have a considerable amount that are in Prop 8. So I think we'll see over the next probably 2 years, give or take, that phased in.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Meacham. With no further questions, I will open it to the public.
Hold on. We have some more.
You got more to tell us?
Okay.
Sorry.
Not off the hook yet.
Is there going to be a quiz at the end of this?
So what I want to spend a few minutes talking about, we're in a situation we obviously haven't been in nearly 7 years. The focus has been about how to go about balancing the budget, how to go about cutting, and I think we've had a very methodical approach in doing so. So I want to talk about what that dynamic looks like if we're essentially break even, or if we do actually have a couple million dollars above and beyond the break-even point. You can see here a quick snapshot of where does the money go. Roughly 60% goes to salary and benefits. It's not a big surprise. We're a service organization. We don't do a lot of manufacturing of actual goods. And, in fact, if you look at most of the services and supplies, those are used to support staff in the way of, obviously, offices and equipment and that sort of thing. So, again, our biggest lever is on the salary and benefits side, and that's why addressing labor costs has been a big part of our overall budget balancing strategies and solutions over the past few years. But let's take a look at how our budget policies are designed and what we've done over the past 7 years, and I think it applies going forward as well. We've had our three big categories, if you will, what we're calling financial security. These are our reserves and designations and our contingency, essentially our bank account to help mitigate unforeseen events. And as we talked about last week with the federal shutdown, we're able to keep services going where we're not receiving money from the feds. If we not have reserves and designations, contingencies in place, we might not be able to have the cash to cover the cash flow shortage, if you will, from the feds, and might have to be sitting here right now making very difficult decisions about which programs to continue and which to stop. Fortunately, we're not in that situation. As long as the federal government does come to resolution at some point, we should be in relatively sound shape. Second component, obviously, labor costs. And what we've done over the past few years is help contain labor costs, keep them from growing. Couple points, things that we have not done. We have not cut anybody's base salary. We did not implement furloughs, as many other folks have done. What we've done is keep wages flat, and folks have paid more for their pensions, and employees have also paid for more for their health care. On average, it's resulted in a give or take a 5% reduction in net pay over the past 5 years. We've also implemented lower tier pension plans, lower benefit, lower cost for new employees. Currently, state law prohibits us from implementing reduced pensions for existing employees and retirees. And then the last component, and the most significant component, has been the impact of programs and services. We've had to cut back there as well. We've reduced the workforce by over 200 positions, or roughly 10% in the last 7 years, and there have been many service and program impacts to go along with those reductions. So going forward, I think we want to take an equally methodical approach and look at these three categories, and as we begin to gradually build back, how can we spread some of this funding, if you will, across these three categories? The challenge is $4 million, while it sounds like a nice number in this in comparison to a $414 million budget, is not that much money in the scheme of things. And that's what I want to talk through here for just a few moments. So looking at our bank account, our reserves and designations, this is one-time money that sits in the bank, if you will, and our target is to have 20% as a percentage of the operating budget. And we're really close to that. We're in pretty good shape as far as that goes. We also have in our financial security component, category are contingencies. Now, these are a percent of the overall operating budget, and our goal is 5%. We're currently at 4%. 4% equates to just under $16 million, so if we were to move to 5, it would be about an additional $4 million, or that entire amount. So I think what we would probably want to do, and we'll talk more about this in early December when we come back to your board for to set priorities going forward and reviewing our budget goals and policies, is we incrementally move back towards the 5%. Obviously, it would be up to your board. At this point, I'm not suggesting that we would take that $4 million and put it completely back into contingencies to get to that 5%. It's certainly an option your board could consider, but we'll want to take that into consideration with some of the other issues as well. If you look at labor costs, one of the big challenges that payroll is a 1% increase across the board is about $2.3 million, which would be more than half of that dollar amount. Obviously, 1% isn't very much in the scheme of things, and yet it comes with about a $2.5 million price tag. And then lastly, so programs and services. In any given year, we ask departments to provide their budgets for what it costs to keep doing what they're doing, but then also to submit proposals for what services they think they need to add in order to meet their customer and stakeholder expectations, wants, and needs. And in any given year, that equates to about an additional $3 to $8 million of requests. Now, we've obviously not been able to fund very many of these over the past 7 years. We have been able to fund a few here and there. But as you can see, we're going to have several competing interests and not enough money to address all three categories. So again, the decision ultimately that will rest with your board here over the next several months and ultimately into budget hearings next June, this is really the first step of our 14-15 budget process, is how to strike that balance and how to spread that that funding. And before I hand it back over to Mr. Savage, are there any questions on that component?
On the longer-term outlook? Seeing none.
Okay, I'll dive right back in then. First, a little bit of history about where we've been and what the seven-year pain plan has looked like, and then I'll move into some future outlook a little more. As you can see here, beginning in 2008-2009, we had a gap that was $18 million, 09-10, $30 million when we, of course, cut contingencies, and as you can see, it's kind of dwindled as we've gone further and further through the seven-year plan. And again, as Mr. Buckshy said earlier, happily, we're in structural balance, or we appear to be in structural balance, and the new normal beginning next fiscal year. This is the slide that was used the last few years to kind of show how that was dealt with. As you can see on the left side there, the short-term versus in long-term, short versus long-term approaches we took to cut those gaps. So in 10-11, 25% versus 75% to get to the $17 million on down. And again, at the bottom there, again, very happily, looks to be structural balance for 2014-15. We talked a little bit earlier about revenues and expense. Here's a chart that shows the difference between those two, the red line being the expense and the yellow line being the revenues. You can see the gap in the middle there is the gap we are challenged to try and cover. The increase that you begin to see there in about 2011-12 has to do with things like AB 109, 2011 realignment and the Affordable Care Act, which has meant essentially additional revenues to the county but a commensurate amount of expense. Happily, again, you see the yellow line just peak above the red line on the far right there, which means there's the $3.9 million. I wanted to take just a quick moment to talk about what it looked like prior to 2007, 2008, and what it's looked like since then. This is a view of actual expenditures, and while the line for 2007, 2008 looks like a dead straight line, there's actually some minor waves in that. You know, it was 9, 10, 11% in the years leading up to that. And since then, you can see a much flatter line. And when we talk about the new normal, this is the kind of increases we should expect to see, not the ones we saw through the 2000s and in 1990s and 2000s. So, summary and outlook. Here we go. So, continued slow and steady growth, about 1 to 4%. We continue to have concerns about the federal government and state programs. Also, some concerns about inflation in the out years, and the new normal growth looks to be, as we've mentioned a couple of times, between 1 and 4%. I want to talk just a moment about recent board priorities, because this will come back to play in December when we have the budget kickoff meetings. They've been to meet legal mandates, meet debt service requirements, and, of course, a focus on public safety for the sheriff, coroner, district attorney, probation, and county fire. So, with that behind us, what are the next steps? November, of course, we'll be talking about budget goals and policies. Early December is the budget kickoff. Between December and February, departments will be preparing their budgets and submitting them to the administrative office. Between February and April, the administrative office will review and compile the entire budget. We'll introduce that to you and the public in May, and then June 9th through 11th, we'll have board hearings. Now, questions.
Now, questions. I think you've informed us fully. Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure if this is for Guy or Dan, but in terms of the forecasting for the new normal, how far out do we go in terms of making – I mean, we have already made assumptions based on revenue growth, pegging at about 3%, and we saw certainly in earlier periods, you know, huge fluctuations of the higher that we won't likely see again. Do we have some sense also within that new normal forecast of how our workforce, our county workforces, in terms of you know, aging out and the replacements and the two other tiers that were added to our pension. I mean, do we have a sense of the larger organizational new normal too, as we move forward on the larger budget picture?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and you know, those things we are tracking closely. That is something is we've reported to your board. The current demographics suggest that roughly half of our workforce will be eligible to retire in the next 5 years. Now, whether or not everybody will actually retire is difficult to assess. It's based on everybody's personal situation. But we are seeing that type of retirement trend in certain departments. Planning and building departments, you'll hear from a little later on priorities, is seeing a tremendous amount of turnover, as well as a few other departments. So, yes, we are looking at that, tracking that more closely. And, you know, as you know, back 7 years ago, we did a longer-term forecast, and we saw these trends going out, and we've been managing that plan. What we're planning to do for next year's forecast is do another five-year rolling outlook and dig into those issues in more detail and present those in more detail.
And just as a follow-up on that, do we see, as we're starting to accumulate some of this information in terms of the workforce turnover and some of the ways that that may affect us, are we having to look at the hiring of people who are higher at the higher level than just the entry level in order to make sure that we don't have departments filled with brand new employees with no experience? Is that something that we've started to look at?
Yes, and striking that balance of folks from external versus promoting within is something that each department looks at as they go about their recruiting needs. And additionally, it is a very high priority for our HR department and our departments to look at our hiring process to ensure that it's not only as efficient as possible, but really that we're attracting and then hiring the best candidate. Right now, we still have a lot of interest in jobs. The economy's soft. We're seeing a large number of applicants, and it really comes down to how do we choose the best person. So we're taking a close look at what are our processes and how can we maximize those, if you will, in order to make sure we're selecting the best individuals. So we'll see how that works. I mean, obviously, the challenge is over the next 5 years, and just to put it in a numbers perspective, if roughly half retire and have to be replaced, that's 1,200 folks that we're hiring over the next 5 years. Right. We're really setting the stage for the organization probably for the next decade or more. And so a big emphasis is being placed on the hiring process.
And a lot of years of service in 1,200 people as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hill. With that, I do have one request to speak on the dais here. Mr. Brown.
Mike Brown representing CoLab. We think that probably the most interesting piece of this presentation is the attachment 2, which shows the history of total assessed property value trends. And we wish you would have extended that out 5 years and then added a combined chart extending the sales tax and the transient occupancy tax to sort of get an idea of where you think these revenues go and kind of expose just how much of that segment that increases on the far right side is due to the Prop 8 restorations and how much is actual new growth. Because at the end of the day, for a local government in California, particularly a county local government, that key indicator is what's going on with that property tax, because it relates to your bigger question of the strategic session today. What's happening to us? What does our land use strategy mean for this into the future? And what's that picture going out? It's interesting to see what happened in the past and what the policy did, but with the questions that are out there, what could that future look like? And then from that, maybe there are a couple of different scenarios, and you've sort of edged up on those but really haven't had the discussion. And right now, you're focused and have been focused on the reductions of staff. And your sort of implied strategy here is dependent on, one, as you have stated or staff has stated, not having any cost of living increases for the 2,400 or so employees. And you have some say in that, but you must bargain openly, as you know, under the law. And then how long you can sustain that policy, even if you would do it for the next 2 years of contracts, what are you looking at out there, and what is the hope of the employees and so forth? You know, similarly, you could have problems, and you've discussed these on prior board items with impacts of the ACA and having to pick up more MIAs and what happens with all these new Medi-Cal people under this and so forth. But a big hunking thing that's missing here is you have a huge infrastructure deficit. Your roads, I think, are at LOS 67. You've got buildings. What's the plan to deal with that?
Thank you, Mr. Brown. With that, I'll close public comment and bring it back to the board. Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that's one area that we have over the years, the short time that I've been here anyway, we've cut our road improvements. You know, we've taken money out of that, and I'm hoping that we can find a way to put some of that back into it, because I don't want to see us deteriorate to the point that it costs us a whole lot more by letting this go. So I'm hoping to be able to do that, and then I'm very interested to hear my colleague mention about the contingency and getting that back up to the 5%. I'm big on trying to save the money. We don't know where this is going to go. I mean, we can project all day long, but we don't know if we're going to start seeing this gradual increase. So I kind of take more of a conservative approach to it to see, make sure that we have what we have, keep people in place, and then if we can do something, we will. But
thank you, Mr.
With no other lights up on the dais here, let me just weigh in with a brief comment. I would observe that the fact that we can be even talking about a small surplus at this point has been the result of a huge amount of hard work by a lot of people to execute the 7-year pain plan. Our employees, our departments, our admin staff, and folks that have come before us to put us in an admirable financial position. The fact that we can talk about being at or close to structural balance on this budget didn't just fall out of the air. It just didn't come down from Sacramento because, as we know, things in Sacramento and Washington are not moving forward in ways that we would like to see them happen. So with that, it's been my mantra. And first of all, this is the first increase in revenue that I've gotten to deal with since my first year on the board in 07. I think we had a small increase for the 07-08 budget, and it's been downhill ever since, as the slide shows. But to honor and take advantage of the hard work that we have done with this very painful contraction, I think we need to put every bit as much effort into the expansion so that we build a county organization that can sustain. And I know that we've got a lot of competing interests. I am encouraged to hear from the admin staff that we look at a methodical approach to building back this organization, even as we look out and see a number of challenges. And I definitely look forward to December, when we'll be able to start making specific choices as to what we do going forward in 14 and 15. And so with that, and seeing Supervisor Ray's light on, I will acknowledge her, give her the floor.
Thank you. It's nice that you preceded me on that, because the first thing I've written here is that there's got to be a lot of credit to go to my predecessors, so it's really easy for me to sit up here on the seventh year of the pain plan and say, go us. So I wanted to thank the people that started that plan 7 years ago. I think it's important to recognize that there are a lot of ifs here in the modeling, but the really good modeling got us to where we thought we could go in the right amount of time, and we didn't have to add an extra year onto that pain plan, or at least it looks like we haven't. And so the things that are within our control seem to be falling into place. So there's some ifs here. Again, we have to watch those very carefully. Some of them are within our control, and some of them are not. But you know, if the forecasting is correct, this is a very exciting time for the county. I also wanted to acknowledge that I hadn't thought about this before. It would be maybe instructive to separate out on the property tax revenues how much of that is coming from Prop 8 recovery and how much of that's coming from growth. That would definitely be helpful as we go forward in our modeling. And other than that, I just again wanted to make sure that we credit not only the decision makers that sat up here before me, but the county employees who have foregoed pay raises, the admin that has worked so hard on the modeling, and just the whole county working together to get through this.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So with that, we'll thank admin staff. I turn to colleagues on this. Our next item has a fairly substantial amount of public comment attached to it. We've been at it for a little over an hour. I would propose we take a break, reconvene at 10:25, and go to our next item. Thank you, Madam Clerk. We will reconvene, and I will ask Madam Clerk to introduce our next item, please.
Item number 3, submittal of a report on the economic benefits of Diablo Canyon Power Plant, an economic impact study prepared by Pacific Gas and Electric in cooperation with Cal Poly, the Nuclear Energy Institute, and Productive Impact.
Thank you, Madam Clerk. Mr. Buckshire.
Yes, good morning. Dan Buckshire again from the Administrative Office. And before I hand things over to Emily Jackson, an analyst in the Administrative Office, I thought I'd just provide a brief overview and background of how it is that we arrived at this particular discussion item for today's agenda. Back in February, there was discussion during public comment about the closure of the San Onofre plant, and obviously raise some concerns or eyebrows at a minimum about could that happen here, something similar to the Diablo Canyon power plant. As a result, your board directed staff to proceed with an economic impact analysis of Diablo Canyon, what it would look like if it were to close. As a result, staff built in $50,000 into the 13-14 budget in order to conduct such a study. And along that same time, PG&E was in the midst of conducting its own study in conjunction with Cal Poly. And that study is attached in this agenda item. We'll speak to it in a few moments. You know, as staff, what I was thinking is that we would partner with Cal Poly had we commissioned our own study. So that'll be one of the discussion points for your board today of do you still want staff to do its own study, or should we just use this information that is before us here today? Lastly, before we move into the details, I do want to emphasize the discussion here today is not intended to be about whether or not Diablo should continue to operate. It's essentially risk mitigation planning and a discussion about if it were to close, what would happen and how might we, as one of the many governmental entities in the region, respond or prepare for that potential prospect. So with that, I will hand it over to Emily Jackson.
Ms. Jackson.
Good morning. I'm Emily Jackson from the Administrative Office, and as Dan noted, I'm here to provide you with an overview of the existing economic study and then touch on some of the resources that would be available to our community in the event that Diablo Canyon were to shut down. First, some background before we move into the economic piece of this. Diablo Canyon has been in operation since 1985, and it runs two units, which are currently licensed through 2024 and 2025. When San Onofre Nuclear Generating Station began to decommission earlier this year, Diablo Canyon became the only nuclear power plant that is currently operational in the state of California. Back in 2009, PG&E began the process to apply for relicensing through the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and if approved, that application seeks a 20-year license renewal for both of their reactors out at Diablo. So we're going to talk a bit about some of the economic benefits included in the study. Not sure if everybody had an opportunity to review it in detail. It provides a lot of information related to economic impacts that the plant has at the national, state, and local level. This slide provides just a summary of that. The plant produces over 18,000 megawatt hours of electricity, and that's equal to 22% of PG&E's total electric generation. When considering the direct economic impacts of the plant and then the ripple effect that those then have to the rest of the community, it's estimated that the plant has a total economic impact of approximately $919.8 million on our county and on northern Santa Barbara County. The plant is the largest private employer in the county. It's created not only a large number of jobs at the plant, but the ripple effect that that has had has also created many more jobs out in the community, and those are in a variety of different service areas and industries, including food service, healthcare, retail, real estate, those service areas that support operation of the plant not only, but as well as the employees who work at the plant and live in our community. Perhaps the most direct economic impact to the county and the other governmental agencies in the area, the plant pays approximately $25 million annually in unitary tax revenues, and that's a form of property tax. I'll touch on this a little bit more later. And then finally, having the plant located in the county contributes significantly to our community's emergency planning and preparedness efforts. So we'll talk a bit at first here about how PG&E's property tax in the form of unitary tax is distributed among the various governmental agencies. And I'm sorry that this is a little small, but there are a lot of agencies on there. As I noted previously, Diablo pays about $25 million in property taxes each year. This pie chart shows how those were allocated out. And as you'll note very clearly from the slide, San Luis Coastal Unified School District and the county's general fund received the lion's share of that unitary tax payment. San Luis Coastal being the largest recipient at $9.2 million, and then the county at $6.8 million. That's close to two-thirds of the total taxes paid. And so when we're looking at the impacts of if that tax revenue were to go away, those are the agencies we're really focusing on today, and then some of the other smaller ones as well. So back when the board first started having this discussion back in February, Mr. Buckshy noted that as the plant has depreciated, unitary tax payments have also decreased. So this slide and then the next slide is going to display unitary tax payments as a percentage of total budgets for the various governmental agencies within the county. This slide shows what the unitary tax payments were that went to the county back in 97-98 in context of what the county's total budget was back at that time. So, you know, the column over on the far right shows how much of our budget is made up of PG&E unitary tax revenues. And at the bottom, we look at our total county budgets, about 4.1% just about 15 years ago. Now, today, due to the depreciation of the plant, the percentage has gone down quite significantly. The county still receives a large portion of unitary tax revenue from PG&E, but it actually only makes up about 1.6% of the county's total budget. Even though that's a lot less than it used to be, it's still fairly significant. You know, $6.8 million in the general fund and $7.6 million in total is certainly would not be an easy cut to absorb if Diablo were to shut down. That said, you know, as Dan and Guy just spoke to, we do have a lot of budget balancing strategies, approaches that have served us very well over the past 7 years. Over the past 7 years, we've closed about an $80 million budget gap using those strategies, and we've really endeavored to create as minimal impact to the community as possible. And so in the event that Diablo were to shut down, we would look to continue along that path. Next, this slide also includes some information about the unitary tax revenues that San Luis Coastal receives. And in the context of their total budget, unitary tax payments for San Luis Coastal are much more significant than they are for the county. They make up about 11.6% of the school district's total budget. I also included the Port of San Luis Harbor District. While they only receive about $380,000 in unitary tax revenue from PG&E, that's very significant in the context of their $4.2 million budget. So, moving beyond unitary tax information. I wanted to spend a little bit of time also talking about the impacts that Diablo Canyon has on the county's emergency planning and preparedness. Due to extensive federal regulations surrounding nuclear power plants, there is state legislation which requires that the utility bears the cost of any emergency planning and preparedness efforts related to the utility being within the county's boundaries. And so PG&E every year pays into the state's nuclear power plant fund, and then that money is then available for reimbursement to agencies within the county who engage in emergency planning efforts. In the current year, about $1.9 million is going to be available for reimbursement. The county receives the lion's share of that, $1.6 million, as the lead emergency planning agency in the county. of that $1.6 million that the county receives, about $1.3 million goes to the Office of Emergency Services. NPP funding pays for 79% of the county's emergency services budget. And what that funds is about 4.5 of the 6 full-time equivalent employees in emergency services who do a variety of different emergency preparedness and planning activities related to public information, emergency worker training, drills and exercises, and on and on. In addition to the money for emergency planning and preparedness, PG&E also bears the cost of a lot of the emergency infrastructure that's currently in place due to Diablo. This includes the Emergency Operations Center and the Joint Information Center, which are both activated in the event of an emergency. The intent of those facilities is to be able to coordinate the emergency from an offsite location, and also to be able to coordinate our messaging and release of information to the public in the event of an emergency. The Red Phone system is a technology which enables us basically to communicate quickly and effectively and efficiently with our 7 cities and other agencies within the community. The early warning sirens, those were just tested recently. I think we all know what those are. Those are intended to notify the community in the event of an emergency, as are the tone alert radios. Tone alert radios are used to communicate primarily with the school districts, hospitals, and other specialized care facilities. And then finally, PG&E also provides a lot of training in public information. The total annual operational costs of all of these are approximately $2.6 million. And so if the plant were to go away, PG&E would not have to provide that service anymore. And so if we would have to make a decision about whether or not we as a community feel that it's important to continue these services, and if we do decide that, there's a significant cost associated with that. So, now that we've touched on some of the economic pieces of this presentation, I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about some of the resources that would be available to the community in the event of a shutdown at Diablo Canyon. We're going to focus primarily on two areas, workforce development and economic development. Workforce development. In addition to the direct economic impacts that the plant has, I've also noted that it's the largest private employer in the county. There's about 1,500 employees on site at the plant, and the ripple effect that that has created about 3,300 jobs locally. So if the plant were to go away, we could reasonably assume that definitely those 1,500 jobs would eventually go away, but more significantly than that, that there would be 3,300 additional jobs out in the community that would be lost and folks out of work. So to respond to that, we'd need to focus on workforce development strategies. And the primary way that we do that currently and how we would look to do that would be through the Federal Workforce Investment Act. The Workforce Investment Act was signed into law in the late 90s, and what it does is provides funding to local areas for workforce training, activities, supports to employers who might be on the verge of having to lay folks off, and basically just aims to keep people employed or get people back to work upon losing a job. In the county, we receive about $2.1 million in federal WIA money annually. What that funds is the operation of some one-stop centers. We've got some one-stop career centers. We have got one in San Luis Obispo, one in Grover Beach, and we also have some remote service delivery up in the North County area and in the coastal region of the county. And what that does is those are places for people to go if they're out of work and they're looking for a job. They can go get training, have their resumes reviewed. There's job workshops to link up potential employers with potential employees. And the one-stops also reach out to employers to try and identify you know, jobs that might be available that they can put forward for people to eventually fill. The funding also provides funding to the Economic Vitality Corporation, which I'll talk about in a few moments. And that funding is really intended to help the EVC with their rapid response programs. That's to help employers avoid layoff and perhaps even expand their businesses in order to be able to offer more employment opportunities within the community. So in addition to the $2.1 million in WIA funding that we'll be receiving this year, there's also additional funding through WIA that's available to communities in the event of mass economic events, which is exactly what the potential closure of Diablo Canyon would be in this community. That funding comes in two different forms. There are national emergency grants, and there's also additional assistance funding. Now, like I said, this is really available to communities experiencing mass layoffs. And so in the past, we've had layoffs on a much smaller scale, but we have received some of this additional funding in the past. Back a couple years ago, we received about $300,000 in national emergency grant funding to help with some much smaller scale layoffs, and those are outlined in the staff report. And then just earlier this year, we received some additional assistance funding in the amount of about $200,000, which has also gone towards assisting with targeted layoffs at various companies throughout the county. Those are on a much smaller scale, and so what the staff report includes is an overview of another county's experience dealing with mass layoffs. Back in 2012 in Alameda County, the new United Motors Manufacturing Incorporated plant closed down, and that had a very significant impact. There were about 4,700 workers at that plant, and the estimated impact locally beyond workers directly at the plant was about 20,000 jobs were lost. Now, of course, this is in the Bay Area. There's more industry, there's a more diverse economic base, but the loss of that many jobs was very significant. And so as an example of what additional WIA funding can do for a community, Alameda County received approximately $14.4 million in additional funding. Now, it's difficult to estimate what we would see here in our community, but the NUMMI example provides at least a sample of what we might be able to expect. It's important to note, though, that this additional WIA funding doesn't come before an economic event occurs. And so there's an application process involved, and that's why we can't be certain about how much money we might expect to receive from WIA in the event of a closure. But the NUMMI example does provide a sense of what we might be looking at. That said, the money would come several months after the layoff and economic event occurred, so there would be a need to do some sort of funding or resource allocation in the interim to deal with that. And then finally, I'm going to touch briefly on some of the county's economic development strategies, which might come more into play in the event of a closure. In the county, the Economic Vitality Corporation is really the lead in economic development. And this is really significant, as I said, given that the county's economic base really is not very diverse at this point. We would really need to look for opportunities to grow our economic base, look for opportunities to get people into other jobs and keep them in this area. So back several years ago in 2011, the board endorsed the economic strategy as put forward by the EVC, and that was really a document that was produced in collaboration with folks representing a bunch of different industries in the county. The economic strategy identifies various clusters of opportunity. Those are listed on the slide. side, these are areas that really represent the most economic growth in our county in the past 5 to 10 years. And so the idea is that if we're looking to grow our economic base, these are the areas and the industries that we should be focusing on. Building design and construction, health services, knowledge and innovation, specialized manufacturing, and then the uniquely slow cluster, which is related to agriculture and some of the tourism within the community. So, you know, the message is that if Diablo were to close, we would need to focus more on the economic strategy, look at opportunities to attract businesses and job growth and development within the community, and we would really be looking to do that in these five sectors that have served us so well in the past 5 to 10 years. So with that, that concludes my presentation. I'm available for questions, as are some representatives who are here today from PG&E. And the auditor's office.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Jackson. We will come to the board. Mr. Meacham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a comment and a question. Comment also, PG&E contributed a pretty sizable amount to make San Luis Obispo County the most prepared county in the nation. That was a grant given to the sheriff's office. The sheriff started a task force. I'm privileged to sit on that task force, and they're making some incredible progress with that. I have a question in regard to the siren that PG&E does. Is that only if we have an emergency at Diablo, or can that be utilized for any other major disaster or major problem?
I've got Ron Alsop, our emergency services manager, who can I handle that question.
Good morning, Ron Alsop, Office of Emergency Services. The early warning system sirens can be used for any type of emergency. In fact, we can sound them for tsunami warning. We only sound the coastal sirens. Lopez Dam failure, we can only sound the sirens in that area. So for any type of emergency that required immediate widespread notification.
And in addition to that, Ron, the folks in the outlying areas that are quite a ways out there that are not going to hear these sirens, how do we contact, or how do we make folks aware of an emergency that's taking place? I'm talking about out in the Creston or the Shandon area, places that are kind of remote. How do we advise them?
We do. Our generic term is what we call route alerting, or route alerting, depending on how you pronounce it, where law enforcement vehicles or fire vehicles go through an area and make notifications. And we say that commonly with the large wildland fires in the area, where sheriff's department will mass the number of units, and even the last where fire, Cuesta College Police was up there. So we pull in a number of resources to actually go door to door, if you will, or ranch to ranch in this particular case to notify people. We also have some upcoming technological advances. Cell phones, that as we may remember that Amber Alert earlier this year caused a bit of controversy, but we have that capability to go out over cell phones and some newer notification systems as well that are coming up.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Alsop. Mr. Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if this is for Emily or Dan. The unitary tax and the depreciation, I'm interested if, in fact, relicensing were to occur, how does that affect does it affect the depreciation that's figured into the unitary tax as it's coming down? And I know that when the plant has replaced essential components such as the steam generator and such, that we did get sales tax on those, but I'm not sure that it figures into the overall appreciation of the plant and everything with it. So first question is if there is relicensing, how would that affect the unitary tax? And should it affect the unitary tax?
Yes, it would make a few impacts. As you noted, any time a sizable investment is made in the plant, such as the steam generators, when there was the sales tax that was derived, as you noted, but it also, you know, adds to the value of the plant, and that is factored into the reassessment. You know, I don't know specifically in with respect to any type of numbers, if relicensing were to occur, what that specific impact would be on the assessed value, but obviously the life expectancy of the asset would be increased for a certain number of years, so one would think it would have a higher value at that point.
Right. And for years I've talked, I remember first having a conversation with our former county council, Warren Jensen, and a lot of other people on how, you know, let's look, I mean, we have a plant operating with the potential, well, it has a license for another 10 to 11 years.
an application eventually going forward for another 20 years. And with that, of course, the unintended accumulation of hazardous waste. How could we possibly evaluate the – certainly that you can make an – I mean, I guess you can make an argument, but it, for it to actually work into a – say, a lawsuit against the federal government or some kind of legislation, you'd have to be able to show actual impacts. Is there a way to evaluate the depreciation and the hazard that comes with the fact that a plant that was licensed to operate on our coast, which at no point was the plan, at least from the federal government, to continue to store the waste on site, as has happened, and as far as we can tell, is not going to change anytime soon. I know that the operators of nuclear plants throughout the country were able to successfully sue to recoup certain costs in order to do the cask storage and other things that they needed to do on their operations to make up for essentially the federal government's failure to take care of the disposal of waste. Is there any way? I mean, this is something that I've been concerned with from day one, because at some point, no matter what your opinion is about the plant, it's going to be closed at some point. And I don't foresee any time soon that the waste is going to somehow miraculously be transported to some other place and disposed of. And so there's a very good chance that we will have 20 to 40 years of nuclear waste, essentially a nuclear waste dump on our coast. Is there any way to evaluate the effects and even take into account the hazards if we were to either seek legislation for some kind of way to offset that, or more than that?
Yeah. It's certainly those are things that we can look at, and I did want to emphasize the point that you did make earlier, and that the utilities, you know, did attempt to recoup and are recouping some costs related to having to handle the on-site storage as opposed to shipping it to Yucca Mountain as was intended a number of years ago. You know, if that's something your board is interested in, it's something we could look at further in terms of how to assess what that burden is to the local area of having that hazardous waste here and what some type of offset or compensation might look like.
Well, I think, you know, and maybe that's after we hear from the public on where, you know, and the board talks about what we want to do next in terms of any kind of evaluation and plan. But certainly, if we're not taking into account, and that, you know, I think that regardless of who you are in this community, including the folks who work for PG&E, nobody wants to see, you know, this waste sit there, you know, forever, even after the obsolescence of the plant. So I think that we have to figure out some way to evaluate the impacts and effect of that, other than some of the things that some people we might hear from today talk about in terms of safety or hazard. So
very good. Thank you, Mr. Hill. Ms. Ray.
I think this question is going to be directed at Emily. Just to be able to put this into a nutshell so that the public can wrap their heads around this, because that's the purpose of the economic study. With regard to the loss of jobs, what would that do to the overall unemployment rate as a function of a percentage?
You know, I'm actually not able to answer that question right off the bat. It would certainly go up. I don't know. we can look into that a bit more and get back to the board on some more specifics.
That would be helpful to me because, sure. Again, if we're looking at an overall right now somewhere in the 8%, are we looking at 10? Are we looking at 12? Are we what does that number look like? And that helps us really wrap our heads around what this economic study means. Secondly, I know that with the loss of the funding for the emergency services, there's some decisions to be made by this board about what might continue, and maybe this is more directed at Dan, what emergency services we would continue to keep or whatever. Some of that would be mandated, of course, and some of that would be discretionary. But what would that budget look like, at least as a skeletal cost by mandate, and then maybe what we might have to absorb in the funds, in the general fund?
Well, and that would be a very large policy issue that your board would have to debate. To give you a feel for that, just within the Office of Emergency Services, which is a division of the administrative office, we have approximately six staff plus some temporary and contract help. Typically, a county of our size that does not have a nuclear power plant would have between 1.5 to 2 individuals. So on an annual basis, you know, you're looking at anywhere from $400,000 to $500,000, give or take, when you look at the associated costs for planning. But, you know, it is the much broader issue as well. We have additional support in public health. We have additional support in the sheriff's department, fire, and others to help manage the response. You know, I think in total, if I recall, the number was in and around $2 million that is received, and effectively that would go away. And so the question would be is, would we continue to a heightened sense of response? You know, what I'm about to say I recognize will sound rather odd to some folks, but there's an argument to be made that we're safer in some regards or better prepared to handle an emergency because we have a nuclear power plant, because we would not have these response plans and resources in place if we did not have the nuclear power plant. And I recognize the irony of that statement in some people's minds, but that's really the issue that we'd be wrestling with, is what type of emergency support infrastructure would we want to have in place if we did not have a nuclear power plant.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ray. Actually, Supervisors Ray and Hill have hit on a couple of points that I'd like to come back to when we get to the deliberations on this, both the cost of the nuclear waste storage and what it means in terms of our need to secure appropriate reserves within the county budget to mitigate a potential fast change in the status of the power plant. Mr. Meacham?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll be interested to hear PG&E's what efforts you're making towards this nuclear waste issue. I know that that's on the minds of everybody. The other question, Emily, has obviously, if there were to be a closure or a shutdown, a huge impact to the schools. Are the schools looking at any kind of a backup plan that they would have in case something like this were to happen, or have you been in communication with them at all?
There's been some communication with them in the past. We didn't reach out to them directly in the preparation of this item. As you noted, it certainly is a much more significant impact to them. In all truthfulness, I think our focus is on ensuring the financial stability of the county organization. But, the schools have also been wrestling with budget cuts over the past several years, and I would imagine that they've got strategies in place to deal with those, although in their case it is much more significant.
Okay, and then the final thing, and it's kind of picking up from Supervisor Gibson's point, looking at our budget in the future, some kind of a contingency that needs to be applied, if we didn't have Diablo Canyon to be concerned about, we do have other catastrophes and other possible disasters out there. What would a budget look like that would be necessary to provide the Emergency Operations Center with the staffing necessary to address those? That's something I think we need to talk about at some point down the line, too.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Meacham. Ms. Arnold.
Yes. Emily, I just had a quick question. We talked a lot, I think, in your presentation about the Workforce Investment Act dollars and the career centers and the EVC and that kind of thing to helping with layoffs in the case that those 1,500 employees out of the company were laid off suddenly. But I didn't hear anything that talked about exactly. So even now, apparently we received $2.1 million. A year into these career centers, and I understand, I've been around the career centers, that they help people retrain for jobs, et cetera. But that seems like it's stage one. Stage two would be that those jobs are actually available in this county. And have we been looking into those kinds of things, or are we progressing with creating more job opportunities?
Well, that's a good question. It's one of the things that the Economic Vitality Corporation exists to do, and that's the intent of the economic strategy, is identifying those areas that we've successfully grown in the past 5 to 10 years, and figuring out what can we do to push that even further to create more jobs in those 5 clusters of opportunity that were on that last slide. And so that certainly is a focus as well. The EVC is currently in the process of running a number of different programs, and they've got some others on their horizon. It's a wide range of strategies that they've taken, ranging from small business loan programs to help businesses get up and running to, identifying ways to just make this area more attractive to businesses to locate here. So that's certainly a part of it as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Arnold. Seeing no more questions at this point, I will go ahead and open it to the public. I will offer PG&E the first opportunity to comment, since this discussion centers largely around the analysis of their economic impact report, and we have a slip from Mr. Tom Jones.
Morning, Chairman Gibson, members of the board. Tom Jones representing PG&E. I'm the Director of Public Relations, and with a slight cold, I get a nice radio voice today for the room. So we concur, first of all, with the staff's recommendation and Mr. Buckshine and Ms. Jackson's well-rounded report that you should receive the economic report. What we did to construct it was provide all the data to our local economists, who then took it and are licensed to use the implant model. It's our third such report over the last 10 years. And each time we do it, we rely on an economic vendor and have it peer-reviewed by a major university, the first by UC Santa Barbara, the last two by Cal Poly. So with that, we really step back and say, okay, what does this report mean? How does it put the plant into context? And I think the report did a good job of also talking about the power plant in terms of its production. We think of the power plant for this community, much like the wine industry or tourism industry, that it's a net importer of revenue from other areas. In our case, it's the 48 other counties we serve, because, again, it's over 20% of the power we provide. With that, the power plant has two effects. It has a tremendous stabilizing price for our customers because of its rather predictable nature, and its capacity is so large, we count on it year and year again, where we have renewable coming up right now, but our hydro has been depressed for several years, and that may be likely to continue. With all of those changes in the marketplace, Diablo Canyon's that constant. So moving ahead, wide relicensing, how do all these things interplay? The power plant relicensing, tax base, and I'll get to your comment, Supervisor Meacham, about the fuel issues. So with that, we applied for license renewal in 2009. And the reason for that was simple. We want certainty and longevity in the facilities. And if we assume that we can get an answer of a no, we still need that decade to plan for building additional power facilities. If you look at the Carrizo Plains projects, they were identified in the county's general plan and had a very rare event, a vacant transmission line. But despite willing buyer, willing seller, a general plan that called for that location, and the assets to convey the power, that's almost an 8-year delivery from inception to hitting the switch and having it at full power. So that's why we want long lead time. The advantage for you is you get long lead time if there's a yes or no decision. So you think about economic future. Is it in 11 years that the plant is decommissioned? And there will be economic activity associated with that, but it will be a downward trend. Or is it in 2045? And this report also sets that construct to look at the opportunity cost in an assumed year. The authors chose 2027 because you're either operating or you aren't in that year outside of the 2025 license. So what to do about these dates that we might know and how to plan for them? I think you're already started down the right road, and we've been a proud partner in that. Continued investment in economic development, partnering with the EBC, and trying to diversify the economy as much as we can and bring other energy projects online when we can do that as well. Those have been thoughtful investments. The county's been far in front of other counties that I serve on in similar capacities, and I think you're going down the right path. The question of used fuel and cost recovery. We have done so. We've successfully sued the federal government and recovered about $250 million in revenue that we've had to spend. Now, you don't get that up front. You have to incur the costs and then have the damages to show and recover. So we've done that to hold our customers revenue neutral on this, and we'll put that money back into rates to refund to them over time. The other point I wanted to address was the data points about tax. We had heard 1998 numbers and this number, and it,
it inferred it was a linear progression from one to the other. That's not the case. There were a couple of game changers in the regulatory structure of electricity that had a dramatic cliff effect. Those are back in the early 2000s. And actually, the last 4 years, and I think you have someone from the assessor's office here, the trend has been up from about $21 to $22 million to now $25 million. So actually, it was opposite some of the effects you had on the local housing market. So not quite linear, more of a wave path on property taxes. I'd be happy to pause here and answer any questions you might have.
Questions to Mr. Jones? Seeing none, we thank you.
Okay.
And send our sympathies for your condition.
It's all upside. Great voice. I'll take it.
Yeah, that's right. It is. That's fair. All right. With that, I still have on the dais here well over an hour of public comment at 3 minutes apiece. So I'm wondering whether I could get an indication from our commenters whether there are those in the audience who would speak for 1 or 2 minutes. And we can go 1, 2, 3. So with that, we'll go with the 1, 2, 3 minute approach. 1 minute. Yeah. Just form a line on either behind either lectern, and as you come to the lectern, please announce your name, and we will dig up your speaker slip.
I feel like I won the lottery. Thank you.
Yes, we remember the first commenter every time.
Excellent, excellent. Well, pay heed, please. Sure. And thanks for the opportunity to speak with you. I'm the CEO of the Morro Bay Chamber of Commerce, Craig Schmidt, and I'm not here to discuss the merits or evils of nuclear power or relicensing. I would like to comment on the report on the economic benefits of Diablo Canyon Power Plant prepared by Pacific Gas and Electric. The numbers are quite sobering, and it's not a question of if the plant closes, but when, be it in 2024, 25, or 2044, 45. We're going to have a plan regarding how we're going to deal with the economic impact that that closing will have. Being from Morro Bay, I'm a little sensitive about power plant closings. And distilling the numbers into Morro Bay numbers, we have 76 employees living in the Morro Bay Los Osos area, making almost $10 million a year. It's a significant impact for a small community. So I'm asking that we don't just kick that inevitable can down the road, but develop a real strategy on how we're going to deal with life after Diablo. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you.
And welcome, thank you. Supervisor Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Sir.
Thank you, Council. Good morning. My name is Fletcher Burton, Vice President, Anderson Burton Construction. I'm here to discuss the impact that PG&E has had on our company. We're currently working for PG&E. We're part of that ripple effect in outer community. We're based in Arroyo Grande. And over the last 7 years, we've had to look otherwhere for work, far, far away. And PG&E, an opportunity with PG&E came up, and we are currently working with them. We're employing people from all five districts that are represented here. The project will span 2 years for our company and allow us to rebuild our name in this community. We were at once a 100-person employer company in this county, and we are a woman-owned company. My mother and I started the company in 1999. I tell everybody we are a real woman-owned company, and PG&E, you know, saw that in us and believed in us, gave us an opportunity to do the second largest project of our experience.
Thank you, Mr. Burton. Appreciate it.
Sure. My name is Jeff Thomas. I'm with Plumbers and Steam Fitters, Local 403 here in San Luis Obispo. And Diablo has been our largest client. It's been the economic engine and has been benefiting the local since the construction began in the 60s. Local 403 has about 325 members, the members that live in the community on the Central Coast here and support the local businesses with the wages that they make at Diablo Canyon. During the refueling outages, PG&E hires skilled tradespersons to perform a variety of tasks, and Local 403 is one of the groups inside that of the tradespersons that PG&E relies on to perform those. Diablo Canyon's economic impact on 403 members is very important, and we wish to continue our relationship with PG&E's Diablo Canyon plant in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas. Thank you. Appreciate you being here. Ms. Bean.
Good morning, Supervisors. Judith Bean, Arroyo Grande, Grover Beach Chamber of Commerce. And I just want to say that, that we're fully in favor of getting PG&E the relicensing that they deserve. They have a huge economic impact on the South County, as Supervisor Hill and Supervisor Ray know. A lot of their seasonal employees park in Arroyo Grande, and a lot of them stay in hotels in Arroyo Grande and Grover Beach. And we find that our relationship with PG&E has been a great one. It's been operated safely. Anyone who has gone out there can tell you that they're running a top-notch organization. They're very open and transparent in their communications, and I fully think that now is not the time to take that asset away from our community, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Bean.
Good morning. Linda Hendy, Atascadero Chamber of Commerce President. Thank you for having me this morning. PG&E, we are here to support PG&E on behalf of the business community in Atascadero. They're one of the safest and most reliable utilities in the nation that we're very proud of here in San Luis Obispo County. Atascadero has benefited directly by the support of PG&E. We have over 200 employees living in our town. They support our restaurants, our retail. They go to our, their children go to our schools, and they make our Atascadero a great place to live and work. So we are very much in support of their efforts, and we hope they continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hendy. Any more folks who would like to comment for 1 minute at the lectern? Seeing none, 2 minutes. 2 minute comments. Please go ahead and approach. Ms. Carter, we'll kick off with you, and I see Dr. Groot not far behind.
My name is Joan Carter. I had a question about, or I'm confused about how this is going to work. If the power plant closes and the emergency planners feel that they don't have any more responsibility because the plant is closed, it seems to me that they have full responsibility as long as there's nuclear waste stored out there. I mean, that is the issue. So I wonder if somebody could clarify that for me right now within my 2 minutes.
We'll respond to public comment when all public comments finish, Ms. Carter.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Carter. Dr. Groot, followed by Ms. Seastrand.
Good morning. My name is Henrietta Groot. I live in Los Osos. I want to thank Supervisor Hill for getting a good discussion started about the nuclear waste. That is the big concern, and I'm glad that the board is quite aware of that issue, and I'm grateful that that's the case. The plant will not go away. Even if the plant is closed, it will still be there. There will be nuclear fuel in the reactors, and there will be all that waste. So who is going to be responsible? We can't just leave it all to PG&E. And I don't know whether you know that the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee will go away. They are only responsible for operations. And when I spoke with them about that last week, they said, you might need to ask the PUC for some other commission to help you with the planning. And we will need emergency funding. Who will pay for that? There are a lot of questions that need to be dealt with, and I'm glad that you have the level of awareness that you have. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Green. Ms. Seastrand.
Andrea Seastrand, Grover Beach. And I know there are many challenges facing us, especially on the spent fuel, but I know there's many smart people sitting up here and also in the audience, and I know that concern will be taken care of, especially as technologies will, you know, innovative technologies will assist us as we move forward. I just wanted to say I'm in full support of the Diablo Canyon power plant and also the upcoming relicensing of the plant. It's a clean energy source, and it has played, as we heard, a large economic force within our county. It's provided immense revenues to government entities within the county. But most importantly, I want to stress, and I think other people have, about the high-paying jobs, the head of household jobs that it provides. I'm concerned because I know it was indicated that things are getting better in the unemployment situation. However, I know many people, including people in my family, that are still without jobs, and they're heads of family. I'm retired. I'm able to still live within this county. But I do want to say that I am concerned about our younger families, those working families that want to have the opportunity that I have right now as a retiree living here. And so I don't want us to lose sight of the importance of those working families, and we need to be concerned about them. If it goes away, what is this going to mean about affordable housing, property taxes for these families, and so on. So thank you for bringing this issue up today. It's important that we set our eyes on this and discuss it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Seastrand. We'll switch to the other lectern here.
I'm Sherry Lewis from San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. As long as it's safe and still operating, things are okay until a big, horrible thing happens, and then our county is no good for anything. Nuclear power is not merely quantitatively different from other energy sources, but it's qualitatively different. It's a completely different animal altogether from other energy things. It's just, and the nuclear waste is what worries me the most. When the plants eventually close down, the waste has to be sequestered from the environment for thousands and thousands of years, and all for our energy needs right now. Is PG&E setting aside an endowment to cover hundreds or thousands of years to deal with the waste? The dry casks themselves will last maybe for over 100 years, but what about after that? Who will be in charge? Let us lessen the amount of waste that will need to be continually monitored for thousands of years. Close down Diablo and turn to renewable green energy sources now. Trying to think of the last point I wanted to make in my 40 seconds. I guess the idea is that it's going to have to close down sometime. And a nuclear accident will happen somewhere in the world in our future. To me, it's inevitable. It probably won't be here, but it'll happen somewhere. And when it does, that area around the nuclear plant will be unlivable for a long time. And for people who want jobs here now and a good livelihood, if there's a problem, if there's an accident, you won't have it here. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Mr. Candela.
Good morning, Chairman Gibson and Board of Supervisors. I'm Peter Candela, CEO of the Pismo Beach Chamber of Commerce. And during the last outage, I was asked by our board, the Chamber Board, to do an impact, economic impact study on what really happens in Pismo Beach during that outage. And after going through the number of businesses, especially the vacation rentals, the homes, the hotels, apartments, RV centers, going through all of these people, we discovered that the impact just in housing is $2.8 million in that six-week period. We also looked at the restaurants and other activities. They came out to $1.5 million. And then entertainment for some of the outage workers went in, and I had a chance to talk to at least 40 of them. It came out to about $500,000. So we're looking at a number that is pretty staggering. It's a $4.8 million impact. Now, if you were to add the multiplier effect on that and be conservative with 3% or three times, you're looking at $15 million. That is a pretty difficult thing to lose if the choices were made. We have come to rely on it because we're in close vicinity of the plant. So naturally, they're going to come to us to live and to play and to eat. So you know, we are looking for the extension of the license, and we hope that we don't have to make the decision for our businesses to not receive this revenue. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Candela. Yes.
Good morning and welcome. My name's Elizabeth Bruce. I'm with Mothers for Peace. I'm afraid I might be redundant in some of the things I say, but after all, Diablo was built in 1985. I'm certain many of these arguments were made then, and they've been made in the 90s, and that now we're into the 2000s. So I'll begin. What has fueled the economic growth in San Luis Obispo County? Well, I've identified, of course, education, Cal Poly, tourism, agriculture, and Diablo. Now, only recently has this council come to a conclusion about what to do with the lowering water levels in the North Bay. And I'm glad that you were able to do that. And now you've taken up the issue of Diablo and to make plans for this, which is so important. The impact of shutting down Diablo on the community is important, I understand, from the Chamber of Commerce's point of view. But if the plant is not closed down, you have to consider what would be the impact otherwise. As Sherry Lewis just pointed out, when Fukushima exploded, we have what they estimate a $500 billion, and this is by the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, loss to the people of Japan. Nuclear engineer Arne Gunderson says that the lesson for real life will be that in reality is that accidents don't occur every 25,000 years. They actually occur every 7 years. If you consider Three Mile Island in 1979, Chernobyl in 1986, and three at Fukushima. So we're not dealing with a long-term in the future generation. So I'm very pleased that you're taking this issue up.
Thank you, Ms. Bruce. Mm-hmm. Mr. Simona.
Morning, Supervisors. Welcome, Karen Ray. My name is Mark Simona, and I represent the San Luis Obispo County Electrical Workers. The economic impact of Diablo Canyon on local electricians is huge. The contractors, we have four local contractors working at Diablo Canyon. They're all paying area standard wages and benefits. Safety is always number one at Diablo Canyon for our workers. We go out of our way to send young electricians to Diablo Canyon to learn that safety culture that is so deep-rooted in Diablo Canyon and PG&E system. I just went over some of the quick numbers. To our training for up-and-coming electricians, this is over the last 12 months. We've accumulated just under $85,000, excuse me, from work at Diablo Canyon for our local young generation of electricians working their way up into a career, a head of household income position. We've accumulated in the last 12 months $108,111 to the same tune. We're very fortunate to have Diablo. We are supporting Diablo and their relicensing bid. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Simona. Mr. Dawson, and any other two-minute commenters?
Tom Dawson. Supervisor Gibson had a good question. What about the economic impacts? And the no-growth policies of the board have impacted lack of preparation for the closing of Diablo Canyon, the lack of business-friendly climate in California and locally have been very negative toward developing future business. Where will those people go to get jobs locally? It's going to be difficult. And those jobs may not exist already, probably don't. This is all coming home to bite us. It's this no growth business hostility that we've had for quite a while now. I encourage you to change this and become more business friendly, encourage businesses, bring them in. I used to be a hippie and a Democrat, and I was against Diablo Canyon when it started. And then I became more conservative over the years. And, you know, Diablo Canyon's been operating for almost 30 years, I believe, and they have done a good job in taking care of safety issues. So This debate is sort of like the environmentalist statements about the destruction of the earth. It's all maybe, probably. It could happen. So I encourage you to show leadership. Do the safety work involved here. Deal with the storage issues and go forward and keep this operating in our county.
Thank you, Mr. Dawson. Ms. Appleberg? Oh, I'm sorry. Good.
Okay, so Evie Jefferson.
Yes, sorry, Ms. Jefferson.
I'm one of the one-minute people. I'm just a little bit confused because some of the testimonies have been the economic impact of PG&E's Diablo power plant. We're not arguing with that. There's no doubt about it. What I hope you will consider is that when Diablo closes down, because it will, whether Mothers for Peace achieves a wonderful victory or whatever, eventually the plant will have to close down. And our economy here needs to prepare for that. Yes, the Chamber of Commerce have wonderful comments about Diablo and PG&E and what it does to our economy currently. Yes, we're not arguing with that. We need to look ahead, and I beg for you to plan on that. I won't be living around here when it closes down, probably. I'll be long gone, but it's very important to do that. And I thank you for addressing the highly radioactive waste issue. It is of utmost importance. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jones. If we could get a speaker slip for our clerk at some point. I don't have one in front of me here. Thank you. All right, any other two-minute commenters? Seeing none, we'll go to three-minute comments in the order that they're in front of me. Mr. Brown, Mike Brown, followed by Kathleen Marco.
Mike Brown representing CoLab. You board members might be lucky if it stays open for even the 10 years. You might not be talking about such a long time because following the lead of Southern California Edison, the board of PG&E may find all this too much trouble, too much bad PR, and decide to close it. And I would be pretty sure that if it closes on your watch like that, you guys are going to be candidates for your own job training program that staff talked about here. You know, the real question for you and us in the public and everybody and our CoLab members is, does this board support the relicensing of the plant and its continuation and showing support to PG&E and its board and everybody to keep it going? And it isn't very clear. We've had a lot of hand-wringing about fish and earthquake faults and a seismic study that was originally $16 million and is now $100 million, and we don't know the status of it. And, you know, if you were on the PG&E board, what would you be thinking? And we have no idea. They're facing a $4 billion penalty because of the San Mateo gas line explosion. This company could be in a lot of trouble. And so the real issue here is, what do you think about it, and what's this board going to do as individuals and collectively as a board to say, given that we work with PG&E to manage the safety issues, the future storage issues, what can we do by resolution, by our actions, by our statements to support the plant, to support Pacific Gas and Electric, and move this forward? It's fine that some nuclear engineer who's making $130,000 a year can go to a training program and learn how to make beds in a motel, because that's a lot of our economy. But the real question is, what are you going to do about this? And we need, and some of you are running for election, and we'd really like to know, are you forthrightly, staunchly going to support this? Are you going to exert leadership? And because I'll tell you, if 4,500 or 4,000 people directly and indirectly get laid off, you will be in the training program.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Ms. Marco, followed by Eric Greening.
Good morning.
My name is Kathleen Markov, and I am the Employment Services Manager for Shoreline Workforce Development Services. We are Goodwill Industries of Santa Cruz, Monterey, and San Luis Obispo County, and I manage and operate the Business and Career One-Stop Centers for San Luis Obispo County. So I know that that's been an interest and a question here among this group. And I'd just like to kind of maybe give a little bit more information on some of the things that have been said and asked, at least from my perspective, of running Workforce Investment Act programs at the local level. So as your county administrator said, that a weakness in our economy locally is still unemployment. Although San Luis Obispo County has remained one of the lower percentages in California, it still has hovered at the national level and remains a little bit lower than that now at around 6.9%, but it's still over twice that of what we could consider normal for San Luis Obispo County historically if you look back. So this is a significant issue. And PG&E is part of, actually there are six economic sectors in the economic strategy that EVC is leading, one of them being clean energy. And I know that nuclear power is controversial. However, it is a major player in the energy sector in San Luis Obispo County, as well as a major employer, which I'll talk about in a minute. But from an energy point of view, if we look at other significant assets, including the California Valley, which employed many, many people in its build-out, actually to run a large solar farm employs about 10 to 15 people. Whereas for PG&E, we know that there are 1,700 direct jobs and over 3,500 indirect and induced jobs that are created by in our community. So they are a top employer, and should PG&E disappear immediately, it would have a 33% increase in the unemployment rate, raising us into the 12,000 people being unemployed. We talked about national emergency grants, and I'm here to tell you from the trenches, it takes almost 2 years to secure those funds. And I can tell you by my personal experience during that period, the people with any significant skills that can be used in the county are absorbed immediately by hiring employers. And those that have other types of skills that aren't found here, they leave. In the event that PG&E were to close, we would see droves of people leaving. They would be transferred within the corporation. We saw that happen in many of our other people who have been unemployed, dumping their homes and really having a significant impact on the housing market and all sorts of support services to this. It would be significant. And these aren't just, all jobs are not created equal. The PG&E jobs, the average is $136,000 a year, which is 240% above the average of 57,000%.
Ms. Marho, are you going to be around for a little while since the Workforce Investment Act and job training was a significant portion of the staff report? Colleagues may have questions for you as we get into deliberations.
Yes, and I'm sorry. I know I've gone over 3 minutes, yeah. but it is really important.
It is.
And I support having them continue in this community and during that period really implore you as a board to do as Craig Schmidt said from the Morro Bay Chamber of Commerce, to develop a plan that is proactive at the local level that assures that the workforce system and the economic vitality development agencies in the community can respond appropriately to a significant event that would be if PG&E were to close.
Thank you, Ms. Marco. We hope you can stay.
I can stay. Thank you.
Mr. Greening, followed by Jane Swanson.
Thank you. I'm Eric Greening, and I would urge you not to take an action in support of the relicensing until all the data are in, because it's not just an economic decision. But since we're talking about economics today, there is another side of the ledger to continued operation and relicensing. For example, as part of the relicensing process, what would be right now the impact right on our fishing community and tourist-dependent community if the high-energy seismic survey had not been stopped by the Coastal Commission? How would we quantify that? And this may not have gone away. If they pursue relicensing, they may still continue to try to pursue it. It's just gone away for a while. Is there any way to measure the ongoing impact on marine productivity from continued once through cooling and the impact of that on the marine resources dependent community, fishing and otherwise? What's the impact of sort of the low-grade psychological airplane fear? Happy people tend to spend more money. Last Thursday, for example, there was an emergency training with the RTA drivers. Some of them are now asking some very uncomfortable questions about things they kind of confronted in that training. Then if something happens, obviously, something going wrong and a shutdown without radioactive release such as San Onofre, there's huge economic impacts. That could happen during the recent licensing period as things get older. We still don't know who's going to eat the costs of San Onofre. Less than catastrophic radiation release, if something happened with just what might be called a minor radiation release where there isn't massive displacement of people, not mass deaths, there is still a huge perception issue. And that can cost, because our two counties' main drivers, agriculture and tourism, are both very perception sensitive. People won't buy products where there's a perception of contamination. People won't spend their vacations where there's a perception of contamination. And then, of course, increasing the risk that the worst would happen, Fukushima, over that extra 20 years, a figure of $500 billion was given. That's just a sort of a moving, still collecting amount. We may never know the total economic damage because it's still accumulating fast. The plant, the six units have not been stabilized. Several of them are still in very serious trouble. And groundwater pouring into the ocean. And then, of course, there are the still cascading economic impacts of the physical impacts that have already happened. So we're not going to have a total, except for a running total, on that one for a long time.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you. Ms. Swanson, followed by Laura Mordaunt.
Jane Swanson. I'm a spokesperson for San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. While we all fervently hope that there will never be a catastrophic radiation release from Diablo Canyon, we can't make that an assumption. And, of course, such an accident would have a huge economic impact. I would like to read one sentence from an NRC report. It's an inspection report dated February of 2012. One sentence. The shoreline, the Los Osos, and the San Luis Bay earthquake faults are capable of producing about 70% greater vibratory ground motion than described in the double design earthquake safety analysis. In other words, it is possible to have greater ground motion than the plant is currently designed to withstand based on new information about newly studied earthquake faults. This, the concrete structures would not crumble, I'm not saying that, but some of the pipes that are crucial for keeping the reactor core cooled are not seismically qualified to withstand that amount of ground shaking. I can give you much more information from the NRC on this if I'm asked to by email. Clearly, one such accident would have an enormous impact and wipe out any economic benefits that wipe out the very real economic benefits the community has received from the people who work at Diablo. On a more cheerful note, I'd like to call attention to the work of Slow Clean Energy, a nonprofit. It's working hard to educate various cities within our county and the county on community choice aggregation. This is a plan based on a California law which allows local entities to form their own utilities and create their own sources of energy. This could be a real job creator and create sustainable energy. The Slow Clean Energy is having a workshop on October 24 at 6 p.m. at the library on Palm Street in San Luis Obispo. Their keynote speaker is from the Marin Clean Energy Group. Marin County has such a community choice aggregation plan. They have 100,000 utility customers, and it works, and it's economically very profitable to the customers and to that area. So the idea of slow, clean energy is we can do the same thing here. There are numerous such community choice aggregation districts within the state, and we can be the next one, and that will create jobs. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Swanson. Ms. Mordaunt, followed by Klaus Schumann.
Well, that's not my understanding of the CCA, so that's for another time a discussion. I have not seen those numbers at all. I've seen just the opposite. I lived in Fremont, California when the NUMMI plant closed. It was a tremendous impact on the community. I think we're all in agreement with financial impact. And I think some of the comments I thought were really good. You got a good education here from the public that we're providing information back to you. One of the issues are when we do full circle, with some of the planning that you've all done with the Energy Wise plan, the climate action issues, that's coming back to this board and hamstringing our ability to have other jobs come here. That's a huge impact. And so you're talking about out of both sides of your mouth if you're looking for other ways to mitigate the loss of Diablo and the workforce. For example, Santa Maria Energy is a company. I've gone down to support it in Santa Barbara County. That is a struggle. The Planning Commission just approved that project. And that project will bring prosperity to not only Santa Barbara County, but our county. It'll bring jobs. Where there's a big environmentalist impact, they are going to shut it down any way they can. For 4 years, they've been working on this. Let me tell you, you get involved in this kind of energy process, you will change the prosperity of both counties. But because of the environmental issues, we are hamstrung totally. And as a result of that, I see that you really are providing the opportunity. Tourism isn't going to happen because there will be no cars. There is no the greenhouse gas dilemma will prevent people from driving here. So you can't have it both ways. Economic Vitality Corporation, they put out a good bit of information, but none of it is going to be viable because of the climate action plans that every city is doing in this county and the Energy Wise plan that you all passed. Not all of you, but it has been passed by the county. So those are significant issues. The Topaz Solar Farm, 19 cents a kilowatt. Now it's forced to purchase at 68 cents a kilowatt. So don't tell me clean energy is our solution at this point.
Thank you, Ms. Mordaunt. Mr. Schumann, followed by David Weitzman.
Good morning. My name is Klaus Schumann. I've come from Paso Robles. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I believe that nobody in this room doubts that Diablo Canyon presents a substantial economic benefit for this county. But as Supervisor Ray pointed out for the item before, there are also a lot of ifs involved here. For example, I mean, just one major accident, such as Fukushima, or one botched maintenance, such as in San Onofre, can completely change the economics of a plant, can turn it upside down, and huge benefits can instantly almost turn into huge liabilities. Second, PG&E is a giant corporation. I think we fool ourselves if we believe that PG&E is making decisions based on the benefits for our community here. If we live in a country which is dominated by large corporations, and decisions are made in the CEO boardrooms or at Wall Street, and definitely not for the benefit of local communities, rather for the benefits of their stockholders and shareholders. And I believe we better have been prepared for this. And for that extent, I agree actually with Mr. Brown a little bit earlier here, at least in a small part, where he says those kind of changes can come rather rapidly. And for the matter, I'd like to quote out of an article in the New York Times from June of this year. where the New York Times quote actually the Nuclear Energy Institute. They also participated in the study, which we heard about a little earlier. And it says here that your Nuclear Energy Institute pointed out when Senator Northrop closed, and I quote, old power plants lead conditional existences. They may not survive new environmental rules or other circumstances that require expensive retrofits. And if you think about Diablo Canyon, of course, earthquake, the seismic issues come to mind, as well as also ones through cooling. Those could be huge retrofits or changes, very expensive, which might force the closing. I'm absolutely certain that we are not deciding about the closing of the plant, but rather the decisions will be made somewhere else. And in my remaining seconds, I would like to point out my home country, Germany, has decided by a conservative government, actually, not to pursue any more nuclear power but phase it out. And ultimately, this actually resulted in an economic boom in Germany. Germany, of all places, is now the leader in solar power. Germany is not certainly known for abundant sunshine as we do here. Thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Schumann. Mr. Weissman, followed by David Baldwin.
Good morning, Supervisors. David Weissman, Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. And I'd like to thank you for undertaking this, which I think is really going to be today just the start of a process that began. I know it was supported by Supervisor Meacham. It was just a casual conversation we had a couple of summers ago about the what-if question. And so I hope that this study can be taken today as a starting point where it needs to go. I think, and I certainly wish that some of the representatives of the various chambers of commerce had waited around a little bit longer. Perhaps they've not been kept abreast, as I have provided to Mr. Buckshy and the supervisors, of all the unanticipated and unexpected nuclear plant closures from around this country in just the first now 9 months of this year. Four of them, all for places that had not planned on it. It should be noted that, as has been rightly pointed out, these decisions will be made in corporate offices or by regulators not in touch with San Luis Obispo County, nor asking your input. Just 2 weeks before San Onofre closed at the Public Utilities Commission, the sworn witness and chief of nuclear engineering assured the commissioners that there was nothing wrong with Unit 2. And 2 weeks later, his CEO closed the plant. This can be abrupt. It can be unanticipated. Your desire to plan for this and to know how we'd make up those losses, I appreciate that it's in the nascent stages and look forward to hearing the details. The follow-up questions that were some of them, like reaching out to the school district and asking for more information, or on the job loss. These are all, I think, important considerations. Some of it's been valuable information. I appreciate Mr. Candela of the Pismo Chamber actually laying out for you in actual dollars the amount of money you're looking at, $4-some-odd million. Great. The plan should be what happens if and when that goes away, and how would Pismo re-envision itself. I think the most interesting words were from the Morro Bay Chamber of Commerce in their rather honest admission of what it's like to have a small-town economy dependent on a power plant that lost it and hadn't planned adequately for it. And I think that comment stood out among those presented by the business community as one that shows a sense of concern. Again, we have an example, and I provided it to the commissioners, to Mr. Buckshy, of what's being done in Vermont. Now, in Vermont, they've been given 1 year's notice about the closing of their plant, and they're quickly calling together their forces to come up with a study. And what they're doing is they're looking, and I point this out to Mr. Buckshy and Ms. Jackson, broader. How do they actually envision their whole community fitting in the region? They're in New England. Do they want to become more of a college town like Bennington nearby? We have Cal Poly. Do they want to get back to New England's more industrial roots of mills and factories? How do they want to reinvent their future that's been forced on them? They hired a consultant who specializes in military base closures, and I think perhaps the county might tap into that sort of expertise in their planning. So in conclusion, I applaud the start of this process, but I think the interesting developments will, of course, be in the details as you decide to develop this study in the coming year. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weissman. Mr. Baldwin, followed by Linda Seeley.
Yeah, thank you. I'm David Baldwin. I live in Los Osos. I'm here as the business representative for the Plasters and Cement Masons Local Union. I'd like to welcome Ms. Ray to the board and wish you a lot of success. I'd just like to briefly explain a little bit about how, as a tradesman and a business rep for a craft union, I experience the economic benefits of Diablo Canyon. There's no question that the benefits to local craftsmen as far as our workforce there and their pensions and their health care in those terms, you know, that's, I think, well documented, as well as these head of household jobs and paychecks. And I think that the report, the economic impact report, touched on that somewhat. But I'd like to make another point that I don't think's been touched on so much. And in the trades, you have to understand that our workers, you know, it's common for them to move from project to project. They say in the trades that, you know, a construction job is made to be finished. So the workers that I represent move in and out of Diablo and other projects in the county. And, you know, as they cycle in and out, these same people that work at Diablo, in my case I'm talking about cement masons and people that work with concrete, they go on to build our roads and bridges and schools and you know, our government buildings, including this one, and you know, maybe even your homes. And but the example I think I can make that hopefully you'll kind of shape this up is that, for instance, a few years ago I had an employer that came into the area and they poured a lot of concrete, built some vaults at a local, one of our military bases here in the county. And they got a hold of me afterwards because they had had some real problems with the concrete there. When they pulled the forms off, the walls, instead of being solid, had lots of voids in them. They had some real problems. So the employer came to me. The employer was from South Carolina, actually. I didn't know them. I'd never worked with them. But they came to me and said, do you have the skilled craft that can fix this? We're in a heck of a mess here. And so I knew immediately that I did, because I said, I have the skilled craft, because they've developed and honed those skills in concrete repair, especially. That's, you know, going to be our baby as cement masons. But we've done that over the years, keeping Diablo in shape, especially with the saltwater environment. There's a lot of concrete repair and that goes on there in order to keep everything in shape. So I hope that the point I was trying to make here is that, you know, having a skilled workforce that hones their skills at a world-class facility like Diablo benefits the entire community, in that the craftsmen that cycle in and out of Diablo also end up working in the community and bring up that level of craftsmanship for the whole community.
Thank you, Mr. Baldwin. Ms. Seeley, followed by Fred Frank.
Good morning. My name is Linda Seeley, and I'm a spokesperson for the San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace. Welcome, Supervisor Ray. Thank you. Diablo Canyon is a huge economic asset to our community. And I'm very sorry about that. You know that there are only 64 communities in the whole United States that are economically dependent on nuclear power plants for their backup economy. So we have thousands of other communities in this country that don't depend on something like a nuclear power generating station. We have 6.4 million pounds of highly radioactive waste that are being stored at the intersection of at least 13 earthquake faults that have been identified. Three of those have been identified as major and active earthquake faults. I'm sorry, two of those, the Shoreline Fault and the Hosgree Fault, major active earthquake faults. It's like basing your economy on the production of arsenic or, you know, some hideous radioactivity is the most powerfully poisonous substance. Plutonium is the most powerfully poisonous substance on Earth, right? Here we have 6.5 million pounds of it stored right next to us. This is a fact We can't do anything about that. It's here. It's here to stay. What we do, what you have to think about, you have to look at this in from two sides. You know, the economic impacts are great today. They're wonderful. We're thriving. You know, our children have a great school system. Children are the very most vulnerable people to the effects of radiation also. Out of the school children who lived in the Fukushima area, who no longer are able to live there, 26% of those children now have nodules on their thyroid glands, which will probably develop into cancer. This is only 2.5 years after the accident. It's very real. I know that people get tired, maybe you get tired of hearing comparisons to Fukushima about Diablo Canyon because it can't happen here. It couldn't happen there either. They just, at Fukushima, they had just been granted a license to continue operation just 2 days before the tsunami hit.
Thank you, Ms. Sue.
And 160,000 people who live there are still in relocation centers.
Thank you, Ms. Seeley. Mr. Frank, you're our last request to speak.
Ray Frank at Atascadero. It's nice to see a full board. I'm glad to see Supervisor Ray occupying the empty chair. I just would like to say that a lot of things there are beyond your control, as was recognized in earlier economic forecast that was presented by the county. Incidentally, I think the county staff did an excellent job of trying to project the future, but in reality, we don't know what the future is going to be depending on what happens in Washington this week. So the same goes with nuclear power. Nuclear power is risky, and it's economically risky. It's no longer competitive in terms of the cost of generating power, and natural gas, wind, and solar is starting to become more competitive, but natural gas and wind is much cheaper than solar power. And we are facing a risk because if, for instance, one of the steam generators goes bad at Diablo Canyon, it's likely they'd do the same thing as they did down in Southern California at Songs, the reactor at San Onofre. They'd just shut it down. It takes 5 years to get a new steam generator. You can't operate a plant out there for 5 years without any power coming out of it. You're going to shut it down. The board of directors is going to say shut it down, which they did. And so there's another risk, too. If we have a major accident in the United States, a nuclear power accident, it's likely that we're going to face the same thing as Japan. They're going to say shut them all down. They did in Germany when we had an accident in Japan. So it is a risky enterprise, and you did a good thing by doing an economic study to determine the impact that it would have if it shut down. But it isn't going to be shut down tomorrow. Even if we had a major accident out there, or let's consider we had a major accident elsewhere and it was determined to shut it down, or the steam generator failed, it would be a huge impact for a lot of people, but it wouldn't shut down. I mean, the employment, because it's got to be decommissioned. And they estimate that decommissioning will be more expensive than the actual construction of the plant. So that's the next step. And the economic study is the first step, as David Wiseman mentioned. This is the first step. The study has to be projected out, and it's going to be displacement of people. But it's going to be another construction project, a deconstruction project, and it's going to be huge. And so it's not going to stop employment out there overnight. It's going to change things greatly overnight. Thank you,
Mr. Frank. That is our last request to speak, so we'll close it to the public and bring it back to the board. The supervisor of the district actually asked to lead here. I know Supervisor Meacham has a comment as well.
My main sense of trying to see where we're headed is what we want to accomplish, because as much as I appreciate all the comments today, I don't really see what we would gain from doing another study that shows us how much Diablo how much we would lose. You know, we have a study from three studies actually that show us the economic impact of the power plant now and even its multiplier effects on the economy, as we've heard from other folks as well. So we do a study that basically says minus that. I'm not really, you know, I don't think, the truth is in economic development you cannot plan for the closing of a major employer. No city can, regardless of whether you see it coming and you've planned or not. It's not the way things work in our economy. To my sense, meaning that if for some reason, whether it would be something bad or a corporate decision or a federal decision to close the plant anytime between now and the end of its current license, we wouldn't be able to plan for that regardless. Because the losses, the economic losses, are not something that, you know, we could put plans and say attract Microsoft. Great. It's not going to happen. Attract, you know, you can't do that. I mean, basically, so I don't want to see us, like, entertain an exercise in purely hypothetical, speculative ways that we might be able to replace an impact on this level with something else. That's why we have an economic development strategy for, actually, through the EBC. And there are a lot of things that we might be able to identify. It seems to me that the only way you can ever prepare for transitions, and there is an inevitable transition in our economy at some point with the closing of Diablo Canyon, whenever that occurs, but the only way you can actually plan for it is to basically continue to strengthen your economy now and to do things that we've already identified in the economic development strategy and some other things perhaps that, you know, continue to diversify the local economy and that can continue to provide opportunities to collaborate with the private sector, with Cal Poly and Cuesta and other areas, but to just kind of, we could spend $50,000 and find out what we already know, that if Diablo Canyon were to close tomorrow, this is how much of an impact it would have. It might be gradual over a certain period of time. Ron Alsop would have to drive a older car, whatever it is, but I don't really know what that gets us. You know, to me, I'd rather sort of look at it from the perspective of, all right, what can we do, if we'd like to do, to continue to strengthen our local economy so that when that inevitable transition occurs, it isn't going to be devastating like it is when a community loses a car plant, a community loses another major anchor. You know, this is the only anchor employer that we have that's in the private sector, so it's not something that we can duplicate in a plan and say, well, we just attract another one. That doesn't, you know, what we've discovered actually through the economic development plan and through the, you know, the people who've been involved in it have provided a lot of information, and through companies that have stayed, is that retention is the most important aspect. Helping our companies that are growing to continue to grow and stay here is really what works in a community like ours, not trying to fish out, you know, companies that might relocate here because we have nice weather or whatever it is. So I'm hoping that we can move to, you know, the only thing that I really have great questions about, and I don't even know if there's a possibility to find out, is how we can somehow come up with criteria to figure out the effects and impacts of waste on our community, both now and in the long term.
Maybe we can get to that.
But I don't know that that has anything to do with the economic plans about Diablo Canyon one way or another.
I know Supervisor Meacham has another framing comment that he'd like to make here.
Maybe I missed the whole point of this. This had nothing to do with closing Diablo Canyon down, the extension of the licensing. I think it's almost like our 7-year pain plan. If you don't make people aware of what you have and what the possibilities are, and if something were to happen, some of you would be right back in this room saying, why didn't you plan for this? What were you going to do about it? That was my reason for hoping that we would at least engage in a discussion to make people aware of it, and I think we just did that. The awareness is out there now. Everybody can deal with it however they want to, but, I mean, for example, I mentioned the schools. I would think the schools would have some type of an economic strategy to address the issue if, in fact, it were to, for some ungodly reason, were to close down. I don't want it to close down either. It's a great economic engine for this county. It provides great jobs. I understand the construction industry. I was in it for 20 years. And that's not the point. What would you do if it weren't here? Where would you train your folks, and where would you send them if that happened? I think that just making people aware of the vital economy that it does provide is a good thing. But what happens if? And I think if we don't answer those questions, I think we're not doing our job. And I don't think we need to pursue another economic study of whatever the case may be. I think we've provided that information for all the different entities to take a look at it and say, okay, well, what could we do or what should we do? Do we have a backup plan? I always use the Mack truck test. You walk outside, you get hit by a Mack truck. Who takes your place and what do you do? I think it's important to have these kind of planning in place. We did that with a 7-year pain plan. I think that the worst thing that can happen is the issue of complacency. If everybody becomes complacent and thinks that everything is just wonderful and fine and we don't have to back up plan for anything, I don't think that that's a good idea. And I, as far as the issue about the corporate decisions, they don't really care. They just look at the dollars. I don't agree with that. I think that they have to look at the safety aspect of it. Otherwise, they won't be in business. So I guess I'm missing the point about the argument about are they a good economic engine? Absolutely. That's unquestionable. Do they provide good jobs? Are they a good neighbor? You bet. But what if? And I think that was the whole point of saying, let's look at this economic study to say, what do they provide? Who does it affect? And then you figure it out from there.
Interesting. I think that's going to start a good discussion. Ms. Ray.
Well, Supervisor Meacham hit it on the nose, of course. But to piggyback that and to echo what Craig Schmidt said, it's not a question of if, but when. And pessimists might say that that when could be tomorrow based on a corporate decision, or maybe that will be a lack of relicensing and that will be in 24, 25, or maybe they'll get relicensed and it will be 20 years from now. But in any case, do we know what that provides for us economically now? And that's the question in front of us, and the answer is yes. Now, with regard to, I wanted to talk about EVC and its role in this study and going forward, and I think we need to underscore that, and I'm sorry that Mike Manchek isn't here to speak to this today, but you know, I may be new to this board, but I'm not new to EVC, having sat on that board for several years, and it's important to note that EVC isn't just tasked with this with solving this problem in the future, but they've been working on this issue of diversifying our economy and finding head of household jobs across the county already for years. And it's also important to note that they've done an unprecedented amount of work in achieving some horizontal cooperation between people in the same industries that are traditional competitors, but working together to further the diversification of our economy and the strengthening of our local economy. So with that work and the work that the county's doing here and the EVC vis-a-vis the business community, involving the business community in governmental decisions, that's how we will attack the possibility and the probability and the inevitability of the future. So again, just to kind of sum that up, the question before us today is, do we accept this existing study, do we ask for a peer review, or do we commission an independent consultant? And I think we've found out what we wanted to know from this study. I'm not in favor of spending any more money on a study of this kind of what-if picture. I'm more in favor of going forward with continuing the partnership with EVC and making sure that we can strengthen our local economy to be able to do whatever we can to absorb this when this occurs. Thank you,
Ms. Ray. Ms. Arnold.
Yes, I just had a few comments, too. And it's been my observation for nearly 30 years, really a generation, that PG&D has done a very good job of fulfilling its responsibilities. And I would call those responsibilities keeping our community safe through the life of the Diablo power plant, delivering power to its customers, and also it has a responsibility to its shareholders and financial benefit to its shareholders. And I always think about that when we're talking. Our county is so unique, but, you know, the demographics of our county, there are many parts of this county that the demographics, there's a huge population of retired folks that depend somehow or another on a investment portfolio that very often includes corporate companies like PG&E. So those are the things we don't think about when we're just kind of looking at what's immediately in front of us. We don't really have full control other than trying to support PG&E's efforts in fulfilling its responsibilities. So I agree with my colleagues. Our job up here is to continue to try to diversify our local economy, support private sector business, and work along, just trying to keep ourselves informed and our responsibility to our constituents, trying to maneuver along so that we are as prepared as we can be. And I think that's the key, as prepared as we can be. So I look forward to working with PG&E as a partner in the community for many years to come, and appreciate that partnership.
Thank you, Ms. Arnold. Let me offer a couple comments and see if we can frame some direction to staff off of the comments. I do think Mr. Meacham focused our attention where it needs to be, which is on the what if. And Mr. Buckshy actually led us into this with that this is a question of risk mitigation, independent of what you think about the benefits or the detriments of nuclear power as a way of generating electricity. We have to imagine difficult scenarios here. It's a responsible thing for us to do. And as we look at the at this risk mitigation issue, to me there are two components. One of them is the probability that a closure is going to happen, and the other is the response should a closure actually occur. And I do think there's work for us to do on both sides of that equation, and it's things that I'd like to make some suggestions. You know, if we look at the risk, what are the risks to the closure of Diablo Canyon? We've talked over the last year or two previous about the physical risk, about the natural hazard that might be posed by the seismically active area and that it sits in, and we're working on that. The other is an economic risk, which is coupled with a third category, which is a regulatory risk. And that economic risk is actually at the root of a number of closures of plants that have occurred. Mr. Weissman referenced them, that a number of the plants that have closed in the last year has been an economic decision. It's not a broken power plant like San Onofre, although you could cast that as an economic decision. It simply was going to cost too much money to fix San Onofre, and that's why SCE decided to close it. So as we look at the economic coupled with the regulatory risk, the regulatory aspect of this is almost completely out of the control of this Board of Supervisors. I think for all practical purposes, the regulatory side is out of the control of this Board of Supervisors. But in terms of the economy of generating nuclear power, I do think that there is a place for at least a peer review of some aspects of the study that we've been discussing today, looking at, in particular, the economics of the NRC's post-Fukushima requirements. The NRC is in the process now of developing things that it is going to require nuclear plants to do as a result of their study of the Fukushima disaster. That's going to play into the economics of running every nuclear power plant in this country. The other side of that is basically the price of energy, the regulation of the cost of energy, the market for energy, which is changing as renewable energy sources come on board and as the price of natural gas continues to be very, very low. The economy of running a nuclear power plant is changing. And so I think as I looked through the economic analysis that was commissioned by PG&E, it seemed to me that there needed to be a broader consideration of the economic context in which nuclear power operates. And that feeds into our sense of what's the risk that either regulation or economic decisions are going to close this plant. So that's why I would suggest a little more work. I'm not talking about a whole new study, but I think a little more context for what's happening in nuclear power would be useful. On the other side of the risk mitigation is what is our response should a closure occur. And, you know, I agree, Supervisor Arnold, you know, indicated, you know, about job training. You know, you can't create job opportunities in a vacuum, having them sitting there waiting for folks to train up and then take them. It's really hard to imagine gearing up replacement jobs if people are laid off from Diablo Canyon
in the kind of time frame that would be available as those jobs were considered for termination. That just that those time frames are very different. But as I look in terms of our county's response, I think first and foremost, this county as an organization needs to take responsibility for its own operation. We've seen that the unitary tax is a significant, though not perhaps overwhelming, aspect of our budget as a whole. It is a significant, nearly 80% aspect of our emergency services office. And as such, I think it's incumbent upon this board of supervisors to consider whether we have sufficient reserves in place to mitigate a short lead time shutdown. For a long time, we've had what we call the general reserve, which sits, if I remember correctly, at $8 million. That's money out of the general fund set aside for natural disaster or other sorts of unexpected events, among other things. And in conversations with our CAO, one thought has been that it's been at $8 million for a long time. As our budget has grown, it might be time to start thinking about increasing that general reserve. I would advocate that we should increase it and perhaps designate some of it as a reserve that is specifically under the situation of the potential closure of Diablo Canyon. We have seen nuclear power plants close much more quickly than communities expected. And so I think it's prudent that our staff review our reserves and consider what Diablo Canyon means to this county's operation in terms of a reserve setback. The other two responses are one is short term and one is long term. So the question is, if we were faced with the potential closure of the plant in a 1 year time frame, what would this county do as in the short term as a means of mitigating that significant loss? You know, whether it's more money to job training, whether it's some kind of adjustment of taxes or fees or other things that we have control over. But I think it's not unreasonable for us to consider whether there is a short-term approach the county might take to the economic hit that would occur with a short lead time. And then the third thing is, as all colleagues have indicated, the overall diversification of our economy is the resilience of our economy is, I think, the key to surviving the unexpected, unforeseen, or short lead time closure of this plant. I do think we could usefully, going back to the economic study, I think we could usefully use some metrics as to how the economic impact of Diablo Canyon fits in with the larger economy, and how do we know when we have diversified our economy sufficiently. You know, how can we come up with some metric to say, yes, our economy is robust. Should Diablo close on short notice, this would be the effect. And if it were more robust, the effect would be less. If it were less robust, the effect would be more. So I think that there's still some work to be done in assessing the overall economic impact relative to what exists now and what we hope might exist in our economy in the future. But I think in terms of direction to staff today, it would be useful for us to speak to the question of prudent reserves to keep the county organization going. That's what we have most direct effect over. I'd be interested in supervisors' thoughts on that. Mr. Hill.
Yeah, a couple of things that you picked up on, Mr. Chair, that I think are valuable. I do think looking at, if we're going to look at reserves, we're going to have to look at investment and policy and plan possibilities too. I mean, if at some point in the future, without a doubt, we're not going to be receiving this kind of money, how does the county expect that it will make up for that? Is it, I don't know that we can just save our way to having, you know, somewhere between $5 and $10 million a year that would go missing just in terms of the general fund. So I guess you'd have to identify more than just, do we just sock it all away until we know we have enough money to make up for the general fund loss? It would have to be something more. Sure. Obviously, it would have to be more than that. As to the part about evaluating the economic context of nuclear power, that seems far more detailed than I mean, I guess, and I'm interested in it, and certainly we've talked about it. If we're looking at the NRC's post-Fukushima protocols and some of these other things, we would certainly have to hire an outside consultant to track this in a way that essentially is being tracked right now by the company. We're just going to somehow get a better sense so that we can get a...
If I could, mm-hmm. on that, I mean, that's the company tracking it in its interest. Mm-hmm. I think we should track it in our interest mm-hmm. As well. And given the importance of Diablo Canyon and the fact that we are the only county with an operating nuclear power plant in the state,
mm-hmm.
I wonder whether a case could be made that is something we should spend some effort to understand.
Yeah, I would be interested in seeing. I think that would have to be an entirely standalone analysis, and I would be interested in seeing how that might be constructed. But I think that there's great value in looking at that. I don't see other than the obvious things we do when things happen, even in terms of an economy. There's things in place already. Short term is, you know, I'm not sure that we can do much more than say what's available and what we would do. And you know, you have a $30 million budget gap my first year in office, and everybody makes cuts. We know that. So, again, I think we need to divide between what we want to do in terms of helping to, which is separate, evaluating the, if you want to evaluate the economic context of the continued operation of the plant, that seems like a very reasonable endeavor. If we want to put some more money into economic development efforts, that seems like a reasonable, you know, effort in terms of continuing to diversify. I still have the question, and I don't know that there is an answer, and that may be part of what you were suggesting too, of evaluating the impacts and potential depreciation of having a nuclear waste repository
yes.
in our county.
Yes, absolutely.
Is there a way to somehow get an appraisal or some sort of evaluation of that? It's striking to me that other communities that have nuclear reactors haven't done more to be aggressive towards the federal government's failure on this critical policy, considering that plants are being relicensed all the time without there being an answer to the waste issue. And so I would want maybe part of the evaluation of the economic context of nuclear energy to look at the waste aspect
yes.
as part of that larger analysis.
Forgot.
And that's I see that as a really valuable way for us to look out ahead and be prepared. And so those are my follow up on yours.
Mr. Meacham?
No, without beating this thing up any further, I think we could get a lot of information about what did some of the other areas that have either shut down or have a decline in their nuclear output relative to their economy. What did it do to them? And how can we take a look at that to see what could be the possibilities for us? I'm not interested in a really extended study either. I think all of us have already expressed the issue of spent fuel. I don't know how we deal with that. That's something that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is going to have to deal with. I'm not really interested in another big study. I think PG&E has continued to do these studies, and I think that they're going to continue to provide us with information that will be relevant to our discussion. And so I don't know what direction we need to go with at this point in time. But
Ms. Ray?
Just again to refocus in the same way. Again, that I think that the question before us today is whether to accept this study. And I think that it sounds like we're in agreement that we're ready to accept this study. The question is, do we need to do more? And so perhaps one of the things that I'm hearing my colleagues talk about is having some kind of a contingency plan in place of what this might look like, and have that written down and anticipate as much as we can and work with the EVC to do that. But in terms of what we're doing today, I think, you know, again, staying on the direction to staff of whether or not we're going to accept this existing study or seek, you know, again, the peer review or an independent study for this particular piece of the puzzle of what is the direct economic impact of Diablo on our economy, I'm satisfied that we've got the answer to that question.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Buckshine?
Yes, let me just offer up a few things, if I may, from what I heard, that I think everybody's on board, and try to pin down anything a little more specific. You know, it generally sounds like this study, there's no need to replicate this specific study. It gives us a general sense of the economic impact. You know, with respect to us studying reserves and designations and contingencies, we can certainly do that. I don't see that being particularly difficult. As I mentioned earlier in the financial forecast, the industry target is about 20% to have in reserves and designations, and we're right about that target. And the premise for having that figure is a few things. They're intended to have reserves and designations in place, one, to deal with fluctuations in revenue cycles. Some communities are more dependent upon sales tax than others, others on a transient occupancy tax, or not a very diversified economy, and they see bigger swings in their revenues than frankly, what we do. We're largely property tax and then state and federally revenue-driven. We don't see the big swings. It's also to deal with the unknown, whether it's a natural disaster, man-made disaster, or in this case, some type of economic impact, such as the closure of a major employer. I would broaden this beyond really the closure of a nuclear power plant. It's really about the closure of a major employer. You know, we could evaluate if we think our economy is not as diversified as we think it should be, and there would be essentially an outlier impact with the closure of Diablo. Do we need to increase our reserves and designations beyond the 20% target? Certainly something we can report back on. With respect to tracking the cost of post-Fukushima requirements from economics study, that's one we'll have to dig into a little bit to see what options exist. I think as Supervisor Hill noted, I believe industry is doing that rather closely. We can see what a type of information we can glean, but my sense was the thought there might need to be a more independent, or at least desire for a more independent assessment of that impact. We'll have to dig into that one and report back should your board want to go there. Right. And same with along the lines of trying to put a dollar value on the impact of on-site storage. I'm not quite sure how to go about quantifying that, but we could do some research.
Mr. Hill?
Yeah, that's what I was hoping to. I do think that we need to at least look at, even if it's, you know, we may not be able to get to. It would be nice to see if there's a way to draft a proposal to have an independent analysis of the, you know, of the economic context for the continuation of the plant, in as Supervisor Gibson pointed out, both in its regulatory and market contexts, and also looking at any way to potentially quantify the impacts of the waste. That's a separate thing. I don't know, you know, if we can accomplish that by hiring an industry expert to evaluate that independently for us. I think we should. The decisions that whether PG&E or any other nuclear operator has to make are going to be made, you know, obviously independent of us. So I think that seems reasonable, and everything else seems we could probably designate some of the money we were trying to set aside towards further economic development efforts would be the most reasonable way to go about it. So I would move that we've given staff direction, so we accept the report, and staff seems to have captured direction, so I don't know if there's anything else.
Do we have a second? As I understand your motion, it is move the staff direction that's been part of this discussion.
Correct.
Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Meacham. Seeing no further discussion, we'll just take it on a voice vote. All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed, none. Thank you. We'll look forward to continuing this discussion. I would propose we press on one more item.
Yep.
Madam Clerk.
Item number 4, report on Department of Planning and Building priorities.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Good afternoon. I'm Cammie Griffin, your acting director of the Department of Planning and Building, and I really hope I can get through this without a coughing fit. So today we're here before you to give you our twice-a-year report out on the department's priorities. We were last here in February of this year. This began about 5 years ago. We used to come more often than twice a year, but we've decided to just make it a regular twice a year, coming to you and presenting our department priorities. As you remember, back in 2008, for those of you who are here and for those of you who weren't here, the board established four kind of overarching guiding priorities for the department, and these are up on your screen. And so all of the decisions made in our budgeting and the decisions made in our top 10 list and what we work on in our program development are all based on these overarching priorities that were set back in 2008 and have been refined by your board since then. In January of this year, the department chose four focus areas to really try and zero in on work for the next two fiscal years. And these were process improvements, infrastructure, energy, and economic development. The tables that are included in your staff report are the same tables you've seen every time. Just as a reminder, table one shows those programs and projects that either generate revenue or are offset by revenue. These can include revenue generated by grants. Table two are all our mandated programs, so these are state, federal, and local mandated programs. And table three are really those things that are more discretionary. These are the items that we have budgeted from year to year. And table three reflects the items that are budgeted in 13-14. And also the tables have some highlighted items, and those are on the top 10 list. Tables 4, 5, and 6 are really a kind of an ongoing, rotating years 3, 4, and 5. And when we do have room on our plate, on our active tables in 1, 2, and 3, these are the tables we go to look at to see if there's items that we can bring forward. And an instance of this was recently we received a grant from the CEC, and one of the programs that was listed on tables 4, 5, and 6 was a program out of the conservation and open space element to establish a renewable energy combining designation. So we were able to take that item right out of those tables and pull it up into our working tables. So going on to the top 10, we did complete three items on the top 10 since our last update to you: the Oceano Community Revitalization Plan, the Plan Development Ordinance, and the Camp Roberts Joint Land Use Study. These were all approved over the summer. The remaining items on the top 10 list, I'll just really briefly go over these and where they are. The Land Use and Circulation Element update, which is really a reorganization. The Planning Commission recommended approval, and it will be coming to your board in early next year. The post-construction stormwater amendments, these are state-mandated amendments, are approved by the Planning Commission, and they'll come to your board in late 2013. The Complete Communities Survey, this was a survey that was grant-funded, and it was to cover the communities of Napomo, Oceano, Templeton, and San Miguel. We have completed the public outreach, and the report on the survey. And this is the thing that's taking some extra time. The potential financing options should be complete in early 2014. The Habitat Conservation Plan and the Los Osos Community Plan update are underway. The draft plan for the community plan has been going just recently in the last 4 or 5 months. We've started to meet with a local community group on that and are making good progress. In addition, we should have a draft, agency review draft of the Habitat Conservation Plan available before the end of the year. We've also been working on trying to develop an e-permit system for our photovoltaic, and these would be for rooftop photovoltaic. The idea being that you would be able to just go to your computer to be able to pull a permit for rooftop photovoltaic. We're running into a few little technical issues, as you do when you work in any kind of computer program, but we're hoping to be able to have that available early next year. The next two items are the San Miguel Community Plan update. We do have a draft plan complete and are now preparing an environmental impact report. We are going to complete that environmental impact report in-house. And the infill development ordinance amendments. This was another grant-funded program. We're currently working with a consultant on some low-hanging fruit draft amendments and also some visioning documents. The next three items would be what we would propose as new additions to the top 10 list. The first being the MPower program. This is an expansion of a financing program for energy efficiencies. This was developed in Santa Barbara County. We would expand it up into our county as well as down into Ventura County. This would be grant funded. The next is the item I already spoke about, the Renewable Energy Streamlining Program. This is a grant-funded program with a grant received from the CEC, and it would implement a policy or a program of the conservation and open space element. And the last is something that everybody probably isn't surprised to see on the top 10 list, and that's urgency ordinance implementation. Your board recently provided some direction relative to this. That shows on the slide, including development of a residential offset program, an agricultural offset program, and continuing work on the vesting rights process and procedures. Knowing that we're coming up on some of our top 10 lists that will be done either by the end of this year or early next year, we did want to offer up some new potential top 10 just to give your board a heads up. And these really are two element updates that are necessary and mandated by the state, the first being the housing element. This is mandated that it has to be complete by June of 2014. And the next is the safety element, which actually has a trigger that's tied to the housing element, and that's within 1 year of the housing element update. So as we complete items on our top 10 list, we would be adding these two element updates. In addition, the chair asked that we speak to the idea of resiliency or the resilient communities. And I'm searching for my notes here. Basically, resilient communities are those communities that can easily bounce back from both physical or economic, bounce back both physically and economically from some type of disaster, whether that's man-made or a natural disaster. And this can happen in a number of different ways. And you've heard testimony recently at your public comment period about a conference that was held. And this group that held that conference is called the Resilient Communities for America. And they purport that you can best be resilient as a community by looking at expansion of renewable energy and energy efficiencies, preparation for extreme weather, like we've seen in the United States with the flooding and the droughts, strengthening of infrastructure, and strengthening of the local economy. So we did participate, staff from the Department of Planning and Building, we did participate on a multi-jurisdictional panel as part of that conference. And what we spoke about in particular was expansion of renewable energy, and in particular, the program that we're going to implement and bring forward to you for the Renewable Energy Streamlining Project that we received the California Energy Commission grant for. And I do have to, again, say that we were only able to qualify for that grant thanks to the hard work of Assemblyman Ashajian and his work on legislation to add the county to even have us be able to be eligible for that grant. So that program, as I mentioned before, was specifically outlined in the county's conservation and open space element. In addition, there are other programs in the conservation and open space element, as well as the energy element, land use element, and the safety element that all speak to this idea of resiliency. The EnergyWise plan, which is an approved plan, has a chapter on adaptation, And the planning department participates on an interdepartmental team as part of the county's capital improvement plan, and that deals specifically with infrastructure. So these board-adopted county policies are what really guide staff in recommendations on land use projects and in the development of planning programs. And so with that, we would ask today that you provide direction regarding any changes to the priorities for the departments in the remaining months of this fiscal year, and then that helps us also look ahead to the next fiscal year.
Thank you, Ms. Griffin. Ms. Ray.
What I'm seeing here is I'm looking forward to 15-16 and what we've got coming up two fiscal cycles from now, and I'm seeing a pretty big hole in what we're doing, what we're planning for. And specifically, I'm talking about in the staff report, page 19 of 25. This is not yet budgeted programs and not revenue generating, and about half that page is devoted to the study of groundwater management and management and conservation efforts. And I don't want to wait till 15-16 to start looking at this countywide. We're suffering from a lack of data on this in the North County right now. We're going to be looking at this in the South County in my district, and I would really like to not see us wait till 15-16 to start collecting this data. So, I mean, in my book, this should be a top 10 right now, but I wasn't part of the planning up until today. So I would really like to see that put on the hot plate right now and get that into a very real cycle of trying to come up with some of these solutions before we're looking at the same urgency issues in the South County that we've already looked at in the North County.
Thank you, Ms. Ray. Any other questions for Ms. Griffin at this point? Mr. Hill.
Yeah, to follow up on that, and I would I think we're all probably in agreement with Ms. Ray on that, The issue with the Paso groundwater basin has been very salient, and in the news we're hearing from people obviously all over the community because, it's not just one area. It is our entire county just as it is our entire state. So the question would be, obviously, to Ms. Griffin and ultimately Mr. Buckshy, too, what do we need to do to bump water up into our priority list sooner than later, whether it's bumping down or adding? I think we all have a pretty good sense of the necessity that Ms. Ray spelled out to be looking at things now.
To bump things into the list, in all honesty, you're going to have to bump things off of the list. Some of these items actually are being done. So groundwater management plans are being prepared. They're being prepared. There was one prepared for the Paso Robles groundwater basin, as well as a plan that's being currently prepared for Los Osos. So that one, although not on the active list, is something that gets worked on as funding becomes available, and this is actually done through our Public Works Department. The watershed management plans, those are a little different. Those are a little larger scale. The programs, there's, I think, three or four programs there, mandates that all water purveyors provide pumping data, condition for well monitoring, protect drinking water sources and water conservation programs. Those could be moved up. Those could be something that staff could bring to you as part of the ordinances that you directed that we look at preparing while the urgency ordinance is in place. So we can take a look at adding those to the list of potential options that your board could then direct that staff work on during the time that the urgency ordinance is in place.
And when would that come back, Amy?
Probably, I would say early next year.
Let me add to that, if I may, sure. Mr. Chairman. You know, the question I heard was, how to move up water planning, if you will, and studies beyond the Paso Basin, more countywide up on the list, which, Ms. Griffin gave a partial answer, as we could reprioritize and move other things down the list. Certainly an option if your board wants to move in that direction. The other is essentially to add it and have a top 11 list, if you will, as opposed to a top 10, which would mean likely the addition of resources. And that is something we are evaluating currently, staff, with respect to the impacts of Paso Water. You know, obviously we've been working on it, but it grew in magnitude exponentially here rather recently, and we're assessing to follow through on that program. What does it mean from a resource impact perspective? And then it comes back to either reprioritizing or adding resources. So we can continue with that and come back at a future date as well, as if you did want to go in the direction of a top 11 list, essentially, what would that look like in terms of resources? And we could look at adding mid-year or weaving into potentially the 14-15
budget. When do you think you'll have that analysis, Dan, in terms of working with planning and seeing as how what resources might be needed in order to make the water planning, as we put it in a general sense, a greater priority sooner?
Yeah, you know, in terms of the impact for Paso groundwater, we've been targeting not only planning but public works, council, my office, and coming back. I would like to have that by the end of the calendar year at the latest to come back with a report on what that looks like. I'd maybe defer to Cami a bit with respect to a broader study countywide, what it would mean for planning resources. I can't really answer that timing-wise myself.
Well, is it possible that at least from a best guesstimate perspective, that when we come back before the end of the year on the resources necessary to move ahead on the Paso Water Basin, that we might also have a sense of what else might be needed to bring other water planning throughout the county into the priorities?
We might have a sense of it. I think a better opportunity would be when we would bring forward to you for authorization those potential amendment options, because we would be able to maybe flesh out some of these programs a bit more and put time and staff resources necessary against them and present that to you as part of the staff report.
And that's coming
early next year.
Well, I was just looking at just in terms of, you know, for the board's discussion purposes at least, or consideration, I think there's probably an agreement that looking at all of our water planning is necessary now rather than reacting. So if we have some sense of being able to say, okay, to be able to start moving more quickly on this, it's going to require this and this and this, you know, then with, you know, working with the admin office, we have at least a financial sense of the commitment the board might be willing to make at that time. I would prefer if we could do it before the end of the year. I think that would be more I think that our communities would find that to be more reassuring.
Mr. Meacham?
Well, I think we just got through funding a study for the Pismo water basin area. They're going to be doing that. I think a key component in this discussion needs to be with Public Works,
mm-hmm.
not
yeah.
just planning. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're the ones that's going to be providing the consultants, I guess, to do a lot of these studies. And we're not going to be, I mean, everybody's focused on the North County, but this whole county has got water issues. Mm-hmm. And I think that with the we're going to have to look at the resource capability of what Public Works can provide, what level of expertise is going to be required to do that, and who's going to do it. We have no hydrologist on board. We don't have a geologist. We don't have any of those ologists. So we're going to have to find somebody that can provide us that kind of support.
I actually have Supervisor Ray's light on, and then maybe we'll go right on down the dais there.
Well, I just wanted to add that in this top 10 list, there was some discussion and suggestion of possibly going to a top 11. And I would argue that, okay, great, we can do that. But there are things on this list that in the top 10 that are mandated, and we have to do those things. But then it seems to me that this should be what if there's – I'm not looking at the complete list here, but if there's four things on this list that are mandated, then those have to be the top four. And then this is number five that we've got to put this here. So maybe we need to prioritize this list. And there are things on this list that are nice, but there's nothing higher priority than this water issue right now. So, again, I would argue I think we're all agreeing that it's time of the essence, but you know, maybe we need to make it clear that this is a priority to us and something that we want to put on the front burner.
There are, in fact, more than 10 things the planning department is doing.
Absolutely.
So, Mr. Buckshy?
Yeah, I was just, you know, to that point, certainly it's up to your board to find that balance of what is the priority and how do you want to balance those priorities versus adding to that list. I think a next step that we can work on as staff is to come up with options for what it really means to do broader countywide planning within the within the county. Obviously, there are a few programs that are listed here that Supervisor Ray noted. You know, myself and a few of the department heads here, Council, Planning, and Public Works are meeting within the next week to begin mapping out in more detail the next phase of Paso Water Resources, next steps, program planning. I think we can broaden that discussion about what other countywide planning we might want to consider and come back to your board. I think it's reasonable before the end of the year, at least with an update of where that looks to give your board a better sense.
Possibly you'd mentioned the December budget strategy sessions. Is that a...
Possibly. That's the beginning of December.
Right.
We could try. If not, we can certainly try by the end of the calendar year, but we could certainly try to bundle it with the board priority setting. I think that's scheduled for the first meeting in December.
Ms. Arlen?
Yes, and I agree with my colleagues that we need to be looking countywide. But just by virtue of utilizing the urgency ordinance, aren't we mandated to be working on the Paso, at least the Paso groundwater basin in terms of water, because that was the urgency that water resource planning? Is that part of using an urgency ordinance?
Well, yes. I mean, your board has provided direction specifically to the Planning and Building Department as well as Public Works Department relative to ongoing efforts on Paso Robles groundwater. But, you know, we've got a number of policies in the conservation and open space element that are specifically addressing water that we can go through and see how many are already being worked on but are being done little by little. You know, what would it take to do a more countywide look at some of these? That's
common.
All right. Thank you. With no further question, we'll open it to the public. I have two requests to speak, Eric Greening and Mike Brown.
Thank you. I am Eric Greening, and I would very much like to thank Supervisor Ray for opening the discussion on something that definitely should be a top priority. Obviously, since this was a Planning and Building Department item and not a Public Works item, it was not run by the RAC as to what our priorities would be. But I can't speak for the RAC. I'm just a person standing here who happens to be on it. But if there's a way that the RAC could be of use in looking at that, we're never in the habit of looking at planning and building budgets, but we do look at public works budgets relative to the water resources issues. And hopefully there's a broad enough diversity of minds and areas of expertise on the RAC that could kind of help put this whole picture together, because it is true that the Paso Robles groundwater basin is only one of multiple areas in this county that are at level of 3 severity and where there is a real urgency of addressing the issue. And I think policies that are developed do need to be to some extent locally generated by the conversations in that community, but also that various affected basins can learn from each other and not have to reinvent the wheel. I also have a specific question relative to the Renewable Energy Streamlining Program. The written staff report says that already there are sort of the process is beginning with stakeholders, and those stakeholders are not identified. And so I'd like to question, who are the stakeholders that are already pulled into this process? And given that the major impacts are likely to be to biological and cultural resources, I'm specifically asking, for example, what consultation, if any, is happening with Native people? I would like to ask what biological expertise is being brought in, and environmental advocacy, biologically informed expertise, because those are the principal stakeholders relative to a program that could have impact on biological resources. It is unfortunate that the two large solar projects already in existence just happen to have landed on some of the most endemic endangered species habitat in our entire county. And I think the intent here is to avoid doing that when there are better options for achieving solar production and other renewable production. But that can only happen if the relevant stakeholders are included very early on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Mr. Brown, followed by Tom Dawson.
Mike Brown representing CoLab. One thing that I think would help this discussion would be these various projects that are in process or ones that you're contemplating adding or substituting to the list, that if there were a budget cost attached to them, some of them, and then the FTEs or part of an FTE in some kind of matrix. And that, so it's sort of like you're being asked to buy a car, but you don't know how much the car costs or the alternative cars cost. That's more of a technical thing. But your three key items today, the financial picture, the what happens if the power plant closes, and this one, you're all doing these in sort of separate compartments. And what really needs to be is a strategic discussion. So if in the last item you go, oh my gosh, we better gin up what we ought to do in economic development, and knowing that land use is your key tool for economic development, which is really not in the purview of the EVC, what would you do in these projects that you already have, for example, community plans and so forth, to figure out, you know, what you could put there, what you could grow there by way of retention, and link these all together? It just doesn't fall from the air. And what you really need to do is say, well, if we're doing a San Miguel plan, or we're doing a Templeton plan, or we're doing a Oceano plan, or whatever all these things are, how much land is available for export-based industries, and what, or is there any? And to replace the 3,500 jobs in some scenario, what would be needed for that, and what plans can we make to link those? These things just don't exist in a vacuum. And I think that's real planning. You just can't say that the EVC at some meetings talking about cluster is going to have a mystical effect on this. And, of course, as you know, one of the things they say, you really need to do something about expanding the housing market, and does your or the housing availability to meet the demand, and does your overall scheme of land use strategy actually do anything for that, and how are these things being integrated to make that happen?
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Mr. Dawson, our last request to speak.
Tom Dawson. If ICLEI, which is being represented as resilient communities here, is as benign as Planner Griffin presents, then why are states and counties outlawing these doctrines? ICLEI's charter states the association's mission shall be to build and serve a worldwide movement of local governments to achieve tangible improvement in global sustainability with special focus on conditions through cumulative local actions. First, did we the people ask for an international organization to intrude into our local government and support international goals? Did any of you announce your allegiance to the UN internationalist goals whenever you ran for election? No, I didn't think so. Currently, the whole climate change thing is being laughed out of town with the ridiculous new IPCC report. If you didn't ask, if we didn't ask for this program, then any of you who agree with and implement ICLEI programs are not serving us, but you are serving ICLEI. ICLEI goals, which promote the very vague doctrine of sustainability, are damaging our economy, damaging property rights, and supplanting our Constitution. The idea of cumulative local action has been demonstrated elsewhere, starting with voluntary programs and building the law and ordinance package into forcing people to comply with no choice. This is all written by very experienced and slick professionals to sound good, but uses words that can have a variety of interpretations so as not to be able to be pinned down. This is a very this is a way to obscure and does not have any mention of limited government, free enterprise, private property rights, protected speech, freedom of from searches. This is just an obfuscated, central control doctrine. We don't want it. Please get ICLEI out of our local government. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dawson. With that, we'll close public comment and bring it back to the board for discussion. Mr. Meacham.
Yes, and I'm going to go back to Supervisor Ray's point, and I think it's a point well taken. A lot of these other studies that we're looking at here as far as conservation, open space, the post-construction stormwater, a lot of this is relevant to the water resource capability, mm-hmm. the way I see it. And so I would, you know, I'd be fully supportive of trying to get more of our arms around what kind of a water situation we're in. Basically, what do we have, how do we stabilize it, and how can we enhance it? And I think those are things that we need to take a look at countywide.
Fair enough. And I think your point regarding Public Works is absolutely on. And I think we've discussed, and I don't see any objection among colleagues, to have staff working on what out of these program and policy goals that are listed for conservation open space implementation, what do we need to actually work on first? You know, how are we going to pull those pieces out? How are we going to piggyback on efforts that are underway right now focused on Paso Robles groundwater basin? How can we, leverage efforts there wider and move it up in the priority list? And we'll look forward to the next opportunity.
And if I might, too, you know, so much discussion about the water issues, whether we could, we should, whatever the case may be. Got an email about Stanislaus County right now that has experienced in the last 40 years over 20 feet drop in their water basin. The same arguments are taking place now between rural, residential, agriculture, urban areas, trying to determine do they have the water to sustain what they're trying to do. We're not alone in this, and I think that what we do is going to be looked at very closely by other counties as well.
Very good. I would look to see if staff feels they have sufficient direction. Seeing nods of agreement, I believe we have accomplished what we set out in our last item here. With that, then, we come to public comment on closed session. I have no request to speak, so we'll close it to the public, ask Ms. Neal for a estimate.
Yes, Rita Neal, County Council. I would estimate about 30 minutes
all
today.
Right. So we will report out after that. AGP can be dismissed at this point.